Mesdames, Messieurs,
avant l'ouverture de la conférence elle-même, je voudrais tout d'abord inviter M. Robert Frémont, le trésorier de cette maison, maison de l'Europe de Paris, de parler un petit peu sur
les activités de cette société, association, spa, mais ça c'est pour faciliter et encourager les relations globales, non seulement pour l'Europe. Donc voilà, il va expliquer l'objectif de la maison et à part, disons, dans 5 minutes. Et ensuite, je vais parler sur la conférence elle-même. Alors, Robert, s'il vous plaît.
Merci beaucoup. Je profite de cette circonstance pour parler un peu français, puisque le reste de la conférence se déroulera plutôt en anglais. Tout d'abord, bienvenue à toutes et à tous ici. Welcome to all of you. La Maison de l'Europe de Paris est une maison de l'Europe parmi beaucoup d'autres. Il y en a un certain nombre sur le territoire de l'Union européenne. Il y en a plusieurs en France. Ce sont des centres de conférences et des points de ralliement pour traiter de sujets qui concernent l'Europe. Bien entendu, notre objectif est de rapprocher l'Europe des citoyens, ou les citoyens de l'Europe, dans les deux sens, j'imagine, d'essayer de soulever plus d'enthousiasme pour la construction européenne, mais bien entendu aussi, nous sommes ouverts, comme centre de conférence, à l'expression de toutes les opinions sur ce sujet. Alors, d'abord, vous êtes ici dans un vieil hôtel du Marais, un quartier bien connu de Paris, avec des hôtels du XVIIe siècle en général. Celui-ci a été occupé à une époque, a reçu la visite à une époque de Madame de Sévigné, un grand écrivain français de cette époque. C'était l'hôtel particulier de son tuteur. Ensuite, elle a eu domicile dans ce qui est le musée Carnavalet, en face, qui est aussi un très, très bel hôtel et beaucoup plus grand. Cet hôtel-ci, comme beaucoup d'hôtels du Marais, a subi des dommages. Il y a eu une longue période au 19e et première moitié du 20e siècle où ces hôtels particuliers n'étaient plus habités par des familles et ont été souvent convertis en ateliers. Il est la propriété maintenant de la ville de Paris, et il héberge la Maison de l'Europe et quelques services culturels de la ville de Paris. Alors la Maison de l'Europe est une association de la loi de 1901, une association qui est financée très lourdement par la ville de Paris, qui est notre sponsor principal, qui est également financé par la Commission européenne, qui nous assure des financements par projet, c'est-à-dire que nous avons des programmes de conférences ou de formations que nous faisons agréer par la Commission et qui font l'objet d'un cofinancement. Et nous hébergeons aussi des associations de jeunes Européens qui n'ont pas assez d'argent pour s'offrir une résidence à Paris et qui ont donc une adresse ici. Et au total, c'est donc un foyer d'Européens soutenu par la ville et par des institutions européennes. Nous recevons un peu d'argent aussi du Conseil général de la région Île-de-France, du Conseil régional. Nous avons aussi quelques subsides de fondations privées. Alors notre activité, c'est essentiellement d'abord des conférences dans cette salle, parfois des déjeuners-débats. Nous hébergeons, comme aujourd'hui, des séminaires pour une demi-journée, pour une journée. Et Madame Lalumière, notre présidente, a cherché à développer, elle le fait avec beaucoup de succès et d'énergie, une activité qui, je crois, est très importante. Si on veut attirer les citoyens vers l'Europe, il faut d'abord attirer les jeunes vers l'Europe. Il faut les informer, les former. Et comme nos moyens très limités ne nous permettent pas de nous répandre dans les lycées et dans les universités, nous avons des programmes de formation des formateurs, c'est-à-dire de formation des professeurs, des écoles et des universités à des questions européennes. Nous sommes aussi un point de contact avec la Commission. Au rez-de-chaussée, il y a un centre d'information où des étudiants, des chercheurs peuvent venir prendre des documents et même se mettre en relation par Internet avec la Commission. Voilà ce qu'est la Maison de l'Europe. Nous souhaitons que vous la connaissiez, que vous parliez d'elle et que vous fassiez venir et que vous veniez vous-même aussi souvent que possible. Alors, je vous souhaite un bon déroulement des débats et je me retire pour l'instant de la tribune. Merci.
Merci, Robert. Hello, Val. Could you sit here, please? And live, yes. Before the start of the first session, I don't like to spend a lot of time on the rules of the game. But what I like to see here, that really good debate and hopefully well structured. The language to be used is English, because it's logical to use that language, because papers written in English. That said, I see quite a lot of French-speaking people, and when it comes to an open session for discussion, and particularly, intervention, questions, or your remarks, I would welcome you using the mother tongue. But that must be English or French, and not Japanese, my mother tongue. Well, that said, I have still 2 minutes to start the session. I would just like to thank Robert Raymond once again for introducing me to this very, very historical and beautiful conference room. It is a pleasure of having a number of friends I have got in touch and continue to keep in touch over so many years when I was a central banker at the Bank of Japan in this sort of BIS circle, and also coming to work at the OECD on 4 different occasions, all in all 17 years. Through that, I have the privilege of really making good contact with a number of people outside central banking. I recognize in particular the former Secretary General of the OECD, Mr. Don Johnston, sitting there. He will come to say something very important in the first session, in the open part of that session. And I see a number of others coming all the way from the other side of the Atlantic, and also somebody coming from Barcelona, and one here, Leif Pogrosky, coming yesterday from Stockholm. With his background as an economist at the OECD when he was a young man, and also as a politician, he played a major role in deciding on the Sweden's participation or not in the Eurozone. So I don't like to spend a lot of time anyway, because you have full CV explained in the agenda. So I'll now start the session. First, I would like to ask Val Koromzai. It's a really perhaps unusual way to start with the discussion. But my view that we have perhaps too optimistic assumption that you might have read the papers by Andrei Ikar and Leif Pogrosky, so that I'm spending lots of time in representing their views, I would ask one objective person, having looked at the two papers, and what sort of things he got as main messages in the two papers. And then I'll pass the floor to note contributors to respond to the remarks made by Val Koromzai, and then add something, in their views, what the main points which should be sent across to you and to the outside world. So Val, first, please.
Thank you, Kumi. It really is a privilege to be here and to have the chance to comment on two very interesting papers, the paper by Andrei Ikar and the paper by Leif Pogrosky. What makes it so much fun to be in my position is that while the papers do agree on one very important point, namely, they agree that surveillance was not effective in staving off the global and the euro crisis. So they agree on that, but then the two papers take radically different positions on the implications of this failure. So we have two papers that really do go in very different directions. In a nutshell, The Icar paper argues that the failure of surveillance as it has been practiced, both within the Eurozone and globally, points to the clear need for a stronger, better organized, more comprehensive, broader and deeper surveillance structure. And the paper goes on to develop the elements of such a stronger framework. The Pogrotsky paper, frankly, has a certain resonance of what I would call Euroscepticism about it. The Eurozone is going to have problems because there are shocks where the appropriate interest rate will be different in different countries, but in a monetary union you only have one interest rate. Those shocks are going to cause problems, the more so to the extent that the euro area is not an optimal currency area, but even if it were. And surveillance, he argues, cannot really overcome this problem. What I thought I would do is very briefly take each paper in turn and then end with a few comments which I offer from my own perspective, which is a double perspective. First, I was for a long time the director of country studies at OECD, involved in OECD's surveillance over member governments as the part of the EDRC process, and also as an American looking at the Eurozone from the perspective of a rather different monetary union. So first, the Icar paper. The paper reflects the work that's embodied in the Palais Royal initiative, which was an ambitious attempt by policy savvy economists from major countries in Europe, the US, Japan, and elsewhere, to define a new surveillance framework to underpin a well-functioning international monetary system. A few highlights of the paper, the things that struck me. First point he notes, surveillance has to be of everybody. And here, including and in particular, the big countries. This reminds me of something Jeff Schaefer, who will be on later, mentioned to me years ago when we were having a conversation talking about surveillance. And his point, he said to me, well, you know, international surveillance, really, it's always been about trying to get some kind of international leverage on U.S. economic policies. And in this sense, surveillance has never worked. I think Monsieur Icar agrees, surveillance over large countries, and it's not just the U.S., but it starts with the U.S., but also Germany, international surveillance, if it has worked more powerfully on smaller countries, but big countries has been exempt. Now, the first point Mr. Icar makes is this has to be overcome. If we're going to have effective surveillance at the global and the euro area, every country has to be subject to it to the same extent. He argues that we need a surveillance process that is rules-based, that defines benchmarks, triggers an intervention policy, discussion, and if need be, using instrument sanctions, perhaps also carrots, in order to enforce discipline. It needs to be much broader than the current surveillance framework. He recognizes that surveillance over fiscal policy alone doesn't solve the problem. That the problems that arose, the crisis, was not principally a crisis of fiscal policy. You need to cover, and he identifies, interestingly, private debt as another element that needs to be covered in any surveillance process. Of course, it needs to cover the financial sector. I won't talk about that because the rest of this conference will talk about what can or should be done about financial surveillance and supervision and regulation of financial markets. And he also says that surveillance needs to pay attention to global imbalances and indeed also imbalances within the European Union. This is an interesting question to my mind, because I was very much involved in the question of global imbalances and when are they a problem and are the current account imbalances and do we need to do something about them. I remember when I first came to OECD, this was shortly after when the Reagan administration began, and the issue in global surveillance was the unsustainability of the U.S. current account deficit at the time. You may recall Stephen Maris, some of you, who was at that time, chief spokesman for the OECD. And then he left, but made, I think, a very handsome living addressing business conferences on the imminent dollar crisis. It was absolutely clear that the U.S. external position was totally unsustainable and that it was going to lead to catastrophe. I was at the time responsible then for writing a paper for WP3, which was Working Party 3 of the OECD, which was supposed to look at this question. And Bixio Berenko and actually Andrew Dean and I wrote this paper. We submitted it to the committee. The committee had its discussion, and I remember the summary of that meeting by Jeff Littler, who said, well, it seems that there is no brick wall of impossibility after all. And sure enough, if you look back, what happened to the dollar crisis there? What happened to the current account crisis? That is, I guess I want to make a more general point, that as an economist, we don't know as much as we need to know. We get caught up in things. We think things are catastrophic. And maybe they are and maybe they aren't. I confess, I didn't see the crisis coming. Now everybody says, well, what a dummy. The smart economists all knew that we were headed for a crisis. But that's not so true. Lots of things were changing. Yes, leverage was going up. But wasn't that just optimal diversification? I thought for a long time that this was just a positive sign that financial markets had figured out how to redistribute risks in such a way that you could absorb more risk and you could fund more risky ventures. There's a long, strong tradition of that. So the question of do we know enough, quite aside from anything else, to exercise strong surveillance is a question that I would have about the ICAR paper. Let me turn to the Podrosky paper. Why so pessimistic? Well, he argues, I think with some justice, that even the stronger surveillance mechanisms now envisaged for the euro area wouldn't have prevented the crisis, and there are really two reasons for that. The first reason is that at its roots, of course, the euro crisis was not a fiscal crisis. Certainly not as regards Spain, certainly not as regards Portugal, certainly not as regards Ireland. It wasn't a fiscal crisis. You could have had much tougher fiscal surveillance. It wouldn't have done any good because these countries were performing extremely well by all the criteria that had been laid down. There was no call for anything there. So, and here I suppose they agree, it wasn't the fiscal problem, it was the private sector problem in these countries. But Mr. Podrosky goes on to argue that what kind of surveillance could actually have prevented the overheating, the bubbles that developed in countries like Ireland and Spain? Regulatory? No, because you had a banking union, not a banking union, but you had a monetary union regulating Spanish banks by Spanish authorities wouldn't have done anything. The money would have just flowed in from other banks from other countries because there was free flow of capital. So no single country could do anything. What was needed was higher interest rates in Spain. But, of course, that's one thing the Spanish authorities couldn't deliver. And that's something the European Central Bank couldn't deliver because higher interest rates might have been good for Spain, but they wouldn't have been very good for Germany where there was no property bubble. So he argues that even stronger surveillance could not have, at least stronger macro surveillance could not have prevented it. And if Spain had tried to do it by fiscal policy, it wouldn't have been the fiscal rules that would have been necessary. A tightening of fiscal policy on a politically impossible scale would have been required to dampen the heat of the Spanish economy. Now, clearly there was fiscal mismanagement in Greece. Perhaps in Italy. tighter surveillance, I suppose, could have made things a little less bad in these countries. But there, Leif makes the political economy point, which I, as a my own experience of carrying out surveillance through the EADRC, tend to agree with. There are political limits. If something needs to be done and it's so clear that everyone can agree that it needs to be done, then either you just have a totally dysfunctional government, or there is a political barrier that is so strong that it won't be done. Most of the time, politicians are subject to their populace. And the efforts to push too hard against the political will, Leif argues, can create problems. And I think there's some evidence in what's going on in Greece now. You push too hard, you don't necessarily, you may get some results on the, you have to do this, you have to do that. But we are living in democracies, and I think Leif argues that there are serious limits to enforcing surveillance on countries simply by the fact that we are living in political democracies. And if these are seen, these actions, these demands are seen as coming from outside, you can have political reactions, which make it very, very difficult to manage. So these are the two papers, Radical Debates. I see that I've used up my time, so I will stop here. I will end with one interesting observation, which maybe is something to talk about. Both papers talk about the role of the IMF in global surveillance. And Mr. Icard suggests as a practical measure that Europe should pool its votes to make sure that it has sufficient play in the IMF so that they can coordinate. You can get proper global coordination between the global surveillance of the IMF and the European surveillance carried out by the Commission, that they can adopt similar standards, rules, etc. So it's a plea that Europe needs to take control of the IMF to make sure that it works in proper tandem with Brussels. Leif argues just the opposite. Europe should get out of the business of always directing the managing director of the IMF. We'd be much better served if we had a if the IMF's head were elected on a non-political process. Let me stop there.
Thank you, Val. I'll ask you once again to come back after intervention by the two note contributors. So Andre first, please, and then Leif.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Val, for your comments, which are very accurate. I think that my paper starts from the experience that we had in the Palais Royal Initiative, trying to reinforce the rules at the level, global level, and make the IMF a more powerful instrument for global stability. And this was the center of the task of this initiative. It's not a committee, it's an initiative. And this initiative started with a first vision of the reality, which is a failure of peer review. Peer review doesn't work because it is a kind of pact on non-aggression. France has difficulties. Okay, we are not going to be strong against you because, okay, next time you are going to get support from us, and so on and so on. So peer review doesn't work. So what is the solution? We have to reinforce this structure. Apparently, at the European level, we have a system which is much, much stronger, based on treaties, with sanctions. By the way, the Palais Royal Initiative proposed sanctions also. And it had, theoretically, the possibility to be a binding system. Unfortunately, it did not turn this way. And once again, due to political difficulties, the European surveillance turned to a kind of peer review. I must say that the experience of 1992, where France and Germany decided not to apply the rules, exert a strong negative influence in this respect, and progressively all the rules included in the treaties faded. My opinion, and it's also the opinion of the member of the Palais-Royal Initiative, is that we should have a stronger surveillance based on more constraints. First of all, surveillance should be comprehensive. We should not have only surveillance on a small part of the economic reality. Surveillance should cover all the macroeconomic aspects. And in my paper, I insist strongly on the fact that one of the big difficulties we have with European surveillance is that it doesn't pay attention enough to private debt, which was at the center of many difficulties we had in the past. For instance, this aspect is totally taken out of the surveillance by European institutions. And second rule, in addition to comprehensive rules, we should have a periodical revision. This means that if you start with treaties, it will be extremely difficult to adjust the rules. We are still living with a 3% rule for public for fiscal deficit, which was set up 20 years ago at a time when growth expectation at Europe level was 3%. Now it's much below. So if we have to rebuild this rule now, it will be much less than 3%. But we are still living in this with this image that 3% is a kind of magic number. So I think adaptability of rules is also key. And all this pushes us in the direction of political matter. Is it a political will to have a system in which an international institution based on democratic rules would be able to define the rules, propose the rules, define them, control them, and applicable, and make them applicable. If we are unable to do that, the situation will continue to be in the hand of the force of the market, and we have seen that it's not an ideal world in which we can live. I will stop here just to say that with LEAF, of course, we have many different thesis in our paper, but at least we have a common vision, is that he insists strongly in this conclusion on the need for transparency, and I fully agree with that. In Europe, transparency should be improved in the rules and the difficulty that we have to cover.
Thank you, André. I think I allotted 10 minutes to you, but you have left about 5 minutes. That you have the privilege of using that time when you come to open discussion. So now, live, please.
Thank you. I thought you gave those 5 minutes to me. Well, thank you, Val. Good to hear you explain my views in a way that sounds much smarter than I thought when I wrote them myself. Impressive how you convey my message in a few sentences that took me several pages to write. I tried to improve myself. Well, I read the headline for this conference as the test case of the euro for issues, general issues of surveillance and supervision. What are the limits? And I focused on the limits, not on the possibilities the progress made, but on the limits. And that's why the tone may be pessimistic, although I am also a bit pessimistic. Well, my test question is, if what the intensive reform process that is now under preparation and to some extent being put in place, if the end result of that had been in place 10 years ago, would that have made a difference to this crisis? That is my test question. And when I go through the mechanisms behind this crisis, I see that none of these things convince me that it would have been very much different for the reasons that Val explained. In Ireland, Irish authorities could not have done anything about the demand for credit when they suddenly got German interest rates and their old or even higher rate of inflation. And in a political context, when everybody was praising the Irish government for its policies of deregulation, opening up the markets, accession to the euro, they were branded the tiger economy of Europe. The British Tory party, the present finance minister, said that Ireland demonstrated the benefits of structural reform. Under such circumstances, now in retrospect, economists come and say, well, the government didn't tighten. They had a big surplus, but they should have tightened. Raised interest rates, they couldn't raise interest rates, but they should have raised taxes. They should have raised taxes on property. I mean, in what world do they live? These things don't happen. And for economists to say that I have designed a perfect economic system, and if politicians behaved as if they lived on another planet, then everything would have been fine. That is not realistic. And the same thing with Greece, and I think Mr. Carr explained it much better than I can, this fantastic expression of the peer review can't work because you have this pact of non-aggression. I have participated in so many negotiations in Brussels. I know what it means when somebody comes up to you and say, if you attack this thing in my country, I will withdraw my support for your alcohol monopoly in your country. I mean, these things don't work. And to put all the expectations on them to function in order to make the Eurozone function in the future and get out of this crisis now, that I think it will not happen. And it's good that these things are developed. These regulations are motivated on their own merit. But if we expect them to solve all our problems, then they will remain unsolved and they will remain to burden the economy for a long time. I think we have to be realistic in our expectations. If we take away the two adjustment mechanisms, interest rates and exchange rates, from the national level, that the burden increases, becomes heavier on the two remaining policy elements, fiscal policy and regulatory policies. Let's call it bureaucracy, or a big word. And let's face it, those two cannot be as powerful as exchange rates and interest rates. And we have to be realistic. If we take away those two adjustment mechanisms, that will have consequences, and it's realistic to expect these things to occur once in a while if we have chosen to go this path because of we want peace, we want integration, we want to build a stronger Europe, and all of this. And regulation may be a hope, but we should not be unrealistic. What should we do? I have a few proposals. The IMF. You explained some of the things, I think. The IMF has a very limited legitimacy today because of the way the managing director is appointed. In smoke-filled rooms between two or three finance ministers in Europe, somebody is picked like the Pope. They come out for a breakfast, informs the other finance ministers and say, we have agreed about this name. And the other ones are taken by surprise. They don't know who it is. They weren't prepared. But the big countries, they control a majority of the votes and they have decided. And that's it. And three times in a row, they have now appointed one of their own, more or less. And they all have not been very successful, as far as my view. And one of them, Lagarde, was a finance minister of the country who not even 1 year with her in charge of the budget, put forward a budget that met the Maastricht criteria. Not even once. She is now to be the police for the system. Not very credible. And the rest of the world, of course, finds this institution not very interesting because they have no influence. I agree that Europe should pool its votes. It cannot be defended the way it is today. The Belgium that does not have a currency has more or less the same influence in the monetary fund as India. That's the way it is today. That cannot be defended, and we cannot expect India or China or Russia to pay full attention to this organization as long as it is the way it is today. So transparency, absolutely. But it's not only a matter of transparency in numbers and statistics. It's a matter of transparency in debate, discussion, identification of risks, and not the way it has been. If you identify risks, you're considered a traitor, you're helping the opponents, and you weaken our cause, and you can be fired. Thank you.
Thank you, Leif. Well, we'd now like to move to the open discussion part. And, of course, I will ask Val to join us on this part of the session. But before that, I'd just like to make remarks on Andre Gall's paper. I noticed while reading his paper, he basically, looked at macro surveillance, macroeconomic surveillance. Little has been said about structural policy surveillance. And I think you are justified to do so because you started your work as a follow-up of the Palais-Royal group activity. And that activity, in my view, basically looked at the issues of the framework for international monetary system through the angle of the IMF, which is, of course, the guardian of the monetary system. But at the same time, we have to worry about structural policy surveillance, because it's clear from this experience, particularly in the euro area, a lot of structural imbalances have played a major role. It's not just the problem arising from single monetary policy and can't deal with local shocks and how then fiscal policy could do the job. But another aspect is fiscal structure policy things to make it really closer to the area where you have lost independence in individual countries with respect to monetary policy. So I would say that fiscal policy is one important element in that kind of situation, and of course prudential policies and so forth, but you should really worry about consistency or inconsistency of structural policies and structures of individual member countries. And I would like to hear, perhaps not at this session, but in the last session our chair will come back to this issue of not just how to deal with macroeconomic imbalances, but structural policy issue aspect, and what the role surveillance could play. And particularly in that aspect, politicians' role is so important, because economists arguing structural reform, that's one thing. But in reality, what matters is how can politicians be re-elected by absorbing the recommendations made by the OECD, IMF, and the BRS, or whatever, or the European Commission. Now, I would also like to hear, perhaps from Andre, about the OECD surveillance. He talked quite a lot about the IMF surveillance. He also talked about surveillance by the European institutions. And again, of course, perhaps the limit he had for the volume of his paper for a conference like this. I think he had not touched on the OECD surveillance. In my view, I was interested in hearing his views on the weaknesses of the institution with which I was associated for long years like that. Now, in finishing this, I would like to ask, if possible, the former Secretary General of the OECD, Mr. Johnston, who was Canadian minister, politician, and also he commanded the OECD, I think, for 10 years. So if you could agree, would you like to take the floor?
You have a mic. Very good. The reason I said that is I made a few notes on these papers, which I very much enjoyed. In fact, I found all the papers very stimulating. But I've got a lot
more. Please speak slowly if you could, John. Okay.
Okay, you've been saying that for years, Kumi, but I'll try it this morning. I have more questions, frankly, than answers. And a lot of things have disturbed me about the issue of surveillance during my time at the OECD and subsequently. And one of them that immediately came to my attention, all of our attentions, was the Asian crisis. Where I'd just come to the OECD at that time, and in particular, Korea. The IMF, as my recollection is, had given Korea a good bill of health only months before disaster struck, because the macroeconomics were very good. All the macro signs were quite positive. You go back and look at the report and the statements at that time. But the issue of, for example, the Chabals, the 400-to-1 debt-equity ratios, their interlocking directorships between the banks and the Chabals, escaped the attention of the IMF. They had not escaped the attention of the OECD because the OECD was more accustomed to doing in-depth structural analysis. And Michel Condisou called me at that time, having read our report, and congratulated us on it, and said how helpful it was to them in revising. I remember they revised their program at that time. Now, that is something where the OECD was able to identify major structural problems. But just 2 years later, you may recall, Korea again had a problem, this time with credit cards. There was a massive issuance of credit cards to young people who didn't understand much about credit cards, I suppose. And, of course, these micro-structural problems, private debt, which André Ricard actually refers to in his paper, these bubble up into macroeconomic problems, or cannot. Now, the question is, when do they reach a critical mass that surveillance can identify? The dot-com bubble is another issue of bubbles. I don't know what could have been done about that bubble. It's not like a real estate bubble. It's a rational exuberance kind of bubble. I mean, Alan Greenspan effectively issued that warning. But I'd be interested in hearing questions as to how could that bubble have been avoided. It was obviously a bubble, it seems to me, to everybody that was objective about it. But it was based on that theory of the greater fool. It was like the South Sea bubble. You figure you're going to get out before it collapses. So that's one kind of bubble. The real estate bubble in the United States is very, very troubling. And it's pointed out, in fact, Leaf puts, an annex in showing how embarrassed the feds were. But there were a lot of people embarrassed. And I don't know if you recall, Val, but when I went off to Davos in the spring, well, January of 2006, your department, you or Cotis, said, speak to the Americans there about the real estate asset bubble in the United States in the residential section. And we had that Sunday morning session, which Larry Summers chaired. And I raised it. And there were a lot of people in that room, including Rubini. And Larry Summers, in, I might say, typical Summers fashion, said, there's no residential bubble in the United States. He said, strictly supply and demand. I can tell you about New York, supply and demand. Boston, I'll take you to Cincinnati, you'll see there's no bubble. He was very dismissive of it, no problem, which I reported back. But, you know, obviously he didn't know what he did not know. And that's one of the problems, it seems to me, that often happens in this surveillance of structural issues, that you really don't know what you don't know. It's more important to know what you don't know than what you do know. So I'm very concerned that we'll never be able to come to grips with that kind of micro surveillance as we should. Maybe it can be improved. I don't know how the data is collected and so on. Perhaps in smaller countries it's better. But in any case, that I find troubling. If I could make one other comment about, you know, that you're failing to see these cracks as they enlarge and, but as they get larger. But one other comment is, you mentioned I'm from Canada. And I have, I remember discussing this with Greg Mackey when he was at the OECD. You know, in Canada, we don't have, fiscal unity across the country. Val knows Canada well. I mean, I'd be interested in having a response to this. The fact is the provinces are very independent. They can issue their own bonds, and they get different ratings by Standard & Poor's and Moody's, so you get better rates in one province than in another. The bank rate is, of course, common, which is a problem. And often, as it used to be when I was in Cabot, because Newfoundland was in the pits and Ontario was hot, so basically interest rates were increased in order to cool off the economy in Ontario, but basically seriously injuring the economy in the weaker provinces, which are like the Portugals or the Greeces of the European Union. Now, why is it that that federation works so well? Is it because it's basically so much of the GDP is concentrated at the center? In other words, this the European Union work in progress towards a more consolidated model, say, of the kind that we have in Canada, because certainly, you know, the same thing is true. They don't have any exchange rate flexibility. When the dollar is high, Newfoundland fisheries suffer. But we do have transfer payments. And the transfer payment system in the European Union is not yet really developed. But I would, as perhaps it may be someday, but I'd be just interested in hearing comments from those of you who are familiar with the comparisons between a federation, a loose confederation, or a federation, not a confederation, like our own, and where the European Union is going. But on the whole, I'd say that I sort of shared the pessimism of Kumi's issues paper and Leaf's paper. And I just hear one word about the political economy and the head of the IMF, for example. I think it's important that the people that run these institutions have a political nose. It's very significant. I mean, it's all very well to make recommendations, but, you know, a politician knows what's possible and what's not possible. And Leaf has the advantage of having been a politician and also been an economist and having to deal with these issues. But I often find that recommendations are made sometimes, you know, by economic institutes and by others, which are completely, totally unrealistic, you know, in the context of the real world. And one last point on that is, the politicians should learn. Merkel has the opportunity now. You make the tough decisions right away. I mean, you look what happened in Germany. I mean, you remember program 2010, which was introduced by Wolfgang Clement and Schröder, which was a very ambitious program and very important. And as they say, they planted the seeds and Merkel picked the fruit because it was too late. The benefits were not visible, and so you're not going to be reelected. But you can never tell a politician to do something knowing that he's not going to be reelected if he does it. So that's just it's pretty simple. That's sort of politics 101. Okay, I'll quit there, Kumi. I know you didn't want me to speak too long. Thanks.
Thank you, Don. We are supposed to finish the session by, say, in 5 minutes' time. I wonder whether Val would like to come back, or any of you on the general part, or I'd like at least one participant on the floor to raise hand and talk. Okay, well. Two, and I must close, and then you. Four. I'm sorry, I'm constrained by time.
Well, thank you. You mentioned, Val, at the outset that you mentioned that things might be complicated a bit because not everything is a fiscal deficit, which perhaps can be controlled in some surveillance process, but there's also private debt. That is true, but on the other hand, that private debt had a counterpart, and the counterpart is that you saw risks accumulating in the balance sheets of banks, and there I feel something can be done against it. And even in Ireland, I mean, that is not just a matter of an exchange rate or an interest rate, it is a matter of regulation. Now, your argument, if I got you right at the beginning, was, well, if the national regulator would have done something against it, then there would be a risk that capital would have floated away. If so, well, I think that is a case that indeed that we have a level playing field in regulation across Europe. But apart from that, I think one can probably really agree that it's difficult and that there's, what's that called, pork barrel trading and so on going on. It's really difficult to have a working surveillance and enforcement process. I think we need everything. We need that enforcement process, but we need more, which is also the capital markets. And to enable the capital markets to really monitor risks in an appropriate way and then channel capital to where it should be, that also relates to regulatory issues, because we want an unbiased allocation of capital and not a capital floating to somewhere where the regulation is more lenient than another place.
Thank you. Now, Monsieur, vous parlez en français, anglais, si vous voulez. Sorry, English. Yes, but could you please give us your name and affiliation?
Jean-Jacques Perkel, President de l'Académie de Comptabilité. Just ask you one question. I think is the fact that it seems to me that the excess of regulation has two risks at the moment. First risk, the fact that the more regulation is coming...
Excuse me, sir. On this question of regulation, you have the priority to come back in session 2 and 3. We would like to have somebody on the question of surveillance in session. Permettez-moi de vous avoir la chance de revenir. Oui, l'autre personne là-bas? There, please. I think perhaps in 2 minutes.
Hans Mautz, European Commission. A couple of points, really. Would it have been different if we had in place what we have now? I think the main difference would be in the fact that we are better equipped to fight the crisis now. So what we've seen in Europe is also that contagion has made the crisis worse, and now with banking union, with the European Stability Mechanism, we would be better equipped, really. Then we should not expect everything from international surveillance. It should be multi-layered, and I think the first level, which is national surveillance and governance, is very important. Why is Sweden such a beautiful country in terms of governance? Because it has good governance, and that is one of the elements to success, also to Canada, I guess. And then, just on the debt issue, on the private debt issue, the European Commission now has a macroeconomic imbalances procedure which exactly focuses on debt and imbalances, and the jury is still out whether it will be effective in the future.
Thanks so much. I think I should close the open part of the discussion. I would suggest that some of the issues remaining, particularly Val and others' reaction to remarks or question made here, we'll come back to that in the final session in the context of how to deal with European problems. But we thought that here we'll focus on global aspect of surveillance. And I'd just like to finish with just one word with the publicity of the paper I produced with Paul Atkinson on the surveillance by 3 international institutions, namely the IMF, the OECD, and the BIS, and what lessons we draw out of our review of the performance of the 3 institutions before the outbreak of the global financial and economic crisis. In the last part of the paper, which is available on the internet, the OECD website, we structured 4 set of issues to improve the surveillance process. In my view, and I think that's shared by Paul, we still believe the fundamental issues of surveillance, before going to a political aspect, is quite an important task. We economists challenging how to really look at the framework of macroeconomic analysis, in particular the relationship between the real sector of the economy and the financial market. We really had rather simplistic view of how, well, monetary impetus coming from the central bank would affect through financial market and to the real economy, and this has been challenged. And nothing clear so far will come up from this. This is really one important part, which, of course, we have not discussed here, but we should not neglect. And second, of course, weakness in the institutional framework of institutions, governance, the shareholders' views, and so forth. And thirdly, there's the internal question of staffing, resource issues. That's particularly important when it comes to the analysis on the financial markets. I stayed long in the economics department, which is the really mainstream of the organization, and there's a little resources paid to financial aspect issues. There's another director. I recognize Adrian Wignall is a special advisor to the OECD Secretary General on financial market. He can come back to that, I think, in the last session. But there's also the staffing problem. And finally, there is a question of how to involve politicians, what the role of G20 or G8, whereas you have G7, which is basically the forum for G7 finance ministers and central bank governor. These guys are competent in terms of macro area, but when it comes to structural issues, G7 doesn't work. It should be elevated to G8 and G20, but you don't have really staff working on structural policy issues as we do for macroeconomic surveillance. I just keep this in your mind, and we'll come back to this issue in the fourth session. Sorry I couldn't have time because you kept your intervention shorter than I had expected, but you have put it next time.
Okay.
Sorry. Now, changement d'équipe. You come back.
Well, may I now call again the meeting to order? This is session two. Did you manage your plates?
Yes,
you know the names of the participants. You have their CV in the files. I'm happy to chair a session on microeconomic problems. International organizations are good in macroeconomy, statistics, analysis, but they have no instrument really to deal with purely microeconomic matters. The question is there any system of good surveillance of microeconomic problems, that is to say, the behavior of the individual financial agents? And Madame Siroux is rating companies, or she will tell us if it is efficient, and also market forces. I would argue that the debt crisis within the euro area would not have been the same without the impact of the subprime crisis. The period 2008-2010 has been very detrimental to the budget of some European countries, and the crisis of the subprime shows that the microeconomic surveillance was completely wrong. Nobody had identified the originate-to-distribute model of real estate banks as being a danger. Central banks at that time, I remember that very well, thought that the danger would be with the CDS market, credit default swap markets. It started with securitization, which on the contrary was seen as a very useful tool, making marketable illiquid assets, and so on. So I hope now it will work better, and the question is not to know how identify what didn't work during the last crisis, but to foresee where there will be market failures or disruptions among the economic and financial agents when the next crisis will burst, let's say in the shadow banking or somewhere else. The first speaker will be Paul Atkinson, on my right, sitting on my right. You avail 15 minutes, maybe a little less if you can, and then we have two discussions. May I ask you both to be short, maybe 5 minutes each, so that we have enough room for a debate. Paul. You have the floor.
Let me move it. Okay. Thank you, Robert. Let me try to make 4 points. First, don't rely too much on supervisors, who are pillar two in Basel terminology. We started the day with surveillance and its limits. Supervision suffers from many of the same limits. Supervisors are people. They operate under political constraints, which restrains what they do. They're detached observers. They're not market participants. They operate under resource limitations, and they're paid a fraction of what the senior bankers that they're supervising earn, which I think must be a problem. We need to rely more on effective market processes and discipline. This requires getting the regulatory and institutional frameworks right. And the starting point here, I would suggest, is to scrap the Basel risk weighting framework. This framework originally was designed, at least nominally, to ensure sensible minimum capital levels in international banks, and to do so they can operate on a level playing field. It's built around the concept of a risk weight, which purports to measure the relative riskiness of assets. A capital charge of 8% of risk-weighted value of each asset was simply accumulated across the portfolio to arrive at minimum capital requirements. The system has lots of bells and whistles, and it's changed a lot over time, but that's pretty much the core of the system. The central problem is the huge variation in risk weights that the system creates that covers a very large range, and I think it is the range of the risk weights and not the increments in between the risk weights that serves as the problem. This invites regulatory arbitrage to reduce risk-weighted assets, which is just an arithmetic construct that serves as the basis for capital requirements for banks, and to reduce it as a share of the total assets of the balance sheet. The concrete result is it fails pretty miserably in its central purpose of ensuring robust capital levels. This chart is perhaps the smoking gun in the thing. Banks game the system. They reduce the regulatory construct that serves as the basis for capital requirements relative to the overall reality of their actual balance sheet pretty much as they like. The big banks, the globally systemically important financial institutions, or SIFIs, are in important respects different from the smaller ones, and I'll return to this in a moment, but that is reflected in the difference of the vertical levels on the bank, of the curves. But both sets of banks respond to the system in essentially the same way. The process is systematic, it's controlled by bank management, and I can see no reason why it should stop. Unless, of course, banks decide they want it to. You can see the result here for the large U.S. and European banks. And here we've adjusted U.S. banks to international accounting standards for comparability purposes. Tangible equity backing for asset portfolios is typically less than 4% in these big banks. You see that in the averages series in the chart. It's often below 3%, which puts leverage of capital in the range of 30 to 40 for many of these banks. Deutsche Bank stands out whenever I put together this kind of a chart, with its leverage of over 60 times its capital. These institutions, I think, are just gigantic accidents waiting to happen, mostly having large counterparty exposures to each other, which will disseminate problems if something goes wrong in the first place. The smaller banks, which are reflected in the bottom line, are generally much healthier and have more robust capital levels. Now, how does this happen? Well, the answer is there are some simple, very flexible management tools that are available to achieve this. The first is the portfolio reallocation of assets from high to low risk weight classes. I think it's no accident that the focal points of the crises we lived through during the past 5 years, subprime real estate and sovereign debt, have both been heavily favored by the Basel system. They've enjoyed what is in effect a regulatory subsidy. Secondly, for the large banks, who are allowed to calculate their own risk weights under the current regime, you have negotiating with supervisors and optimizing,
optimizing models as a ready handy method to manage these the risk weights. And thirdly, you have derivatives, which facilitate easy risk transfer. The whole system really needs to be replaced. The simplest way to go is simply to set a minimum for some all-equity measure of capital, and the existing or the prospective Basel III Core Tier 1 is fine in this regard, as a share of total assets on the balance sheet. How much should this be? Well, U.S. FDIC 5%, the well-capitalized standard, serves to limit leverage to some 20 times capital, and this seems to me like a minimum. You could easily persuade me that it should be larger, but even this would be a considerable advance on where we are at the moment. And thirdly, you could usefully look for ways to reward diversification. Let me go to the third point, which relates to institutional frameworks and business models. A priority has got to be to reduce the interconnectedness in the system so that local problems don't so easily become systemic ones. There's been a great deal of discussion of separation issues. We have the Volcker Rule, Leakin in discussion, and so on. Much of this is badly focused on primary securities, trading portfolios, and especially the purpose or the intent of trading rather than the trading itself. The key issue is derivatives and their high exposure to market risk. Trading of these contracts, mostly over-the-counter, is dominated by a handful of U.S. and European banks, and these are among the designated SIFIs. Now, how big is the derivative mountain? Well, in notional terms, derivative rose from around 3.5 times world GDP, and note that the scale unit here is world GDP, around the turn of the millennium to some 13 times world GDP during the crisis. They've fallen back a bit since then, but not very much. Over-the-counter derivatives alone, i.e. not including those traded on exchanges, have been running above some $630 trillion U.S. dollars over the last couple of years. These contracts are dominated by interest rate contracts, such as swaps, options, futures, forwards. Swaps, options, forwards, futures. And in contrast, primary securities, which actually fund economic activity and provide the reference values for most of these derivative contracts, are much smaller and have been generally stable over time. That's the fat gray line in the chart. Notional values, it has to be said, badly exaggerate the size of these contracts. The settlement exposures, sometimes called gross market values, which reflect the values at which they actually trade in the marketplaces, are very much smaller. Nevertheless, they're still large enough to completely dominate a lot of bank balance sheets. And here I provide some examples. I show Wells Fargo and HSBC to show you that there are a couple of big banks that have quite large businesses without relying on derivatives activities. You have Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. These banks have no real deposit banking business. They're just investment banks, and derivatives dominate their balance sheets. The remainder are the big universal banks, and there's some others that I haven't included in the charts. And their derivatives position on their balance sheet typically runs from just under a quarter to the 50% range of its balance sheets, which seems like a very large amount. Now, an essential point here is that the gross market value of these derivatives, it's not a measure of market risk. The market value is a snapshot of the situation at today's prices, whereas risks refer to your exposure if prices change in the future. Given the effective leverage in these contracts, which is very high, derivative price movements can be huge, and you just have to think of what happens to a call option of a stock that is trading at approximately the strike price. What happens to that if the price of the underlying security then jumps? The price movements are very high. When hedging is imperfect, And banks hedge a lot on these contracts. But imperfection is almost inevitable with over-the-counter products. Balance sheet damage can be very high. A word about netting. This is a very boring subject, which I'm sorry to go into, but it's actually an important part of the problem. Most sci-fi derivative exposure is to a small number of counterparties. For many purposes, banks can very sensibly just net these positions out. I owe you 100, you owe me 99, let's just call that 1. That's fair enough. So market value, after netting, sometimes called gross credit exposure, can be a very small number. It's tiny compared to the notional amounts. And banks often argue that these small exposures are fair representations of the risks involved, so little or no capital is needed. This is seriously misleading. Netting does nothing to protect against market risk. It's essentially a settlement concept. And the rules need to reflect this. There are two separate issues here. One is reporting and the other is capital rules. As regards reporting, international rules are very strict on recognizing netting. You have to show virtually everything on your balance sheet. U.S. GAAP accounting is quite generous. It allows you to net out a lot of things, and relatively small amounts of derivative positions can be reported on the balance sheet. There can be differences of view on the merits of this. I suspect so long as you know what you're looking at, one's probably as fair as the other. The issue for us is capital rules. The Basel rules are complex, and they allow extensive netting much along the lines of U.S. GAAP. They encourage a concentration of counterparties, which seems anti-competitiveness and dangerous for the system, and they underestimate market risk. Now, some numbers here to concentrate the mind. This just concerns the 5 big U.S. bank players in the derivative markets. I think if I could put together these numbers for European banks, it would look pretty much the same. The FDIC has simply been kind enough to give some easily accessible numbers here. Nominal derivative portfolios amounted at the end of the first quarter of this year to some $283 trillion. And I infer from the presentation that this covers both sides of the balance sheet, both of which are exposed to market risk. The gross market value of all this is some $10.6 trillion, which is about 3.75% of the nominal and more or less in line with experience. The asset side of this is valued at around $4.6 trillion. But after you make adjustments for netting and a few other adjustments, you're down to the amount of capital requiring some backing in, the amount of asset base requiring some backing is $282 billion. Now, there's an additional potential future exposure under the Basel system, which is meant to account for potential market risk. And this gets added to the base under the proposed Basel III leverage ratio that may come into effect in 2018. At the end of the first quarter, this amounted to $853 billion. Now, if you add these two together to get a base that would be applied under these rules at the proposed 3%, you get a capital backing for these derivatives of $34 billion, which seems to me rather small compared to the numbers at the top of this slide. Now, what to do about this? Three suggestions. First is to separate large derivative portfolios and related prime broking activities from deposit banking. I think Adrian Blundell-Wignall may be talking more about this in the next session. Secondly, you can base capital requirements on what's left using IFRS accounting to restrict the impact of netting. And thirdly, you can just require higher capital backing than is implied by the Basel III proposal of 3% on the leverage ratio. Lastly, we need to strengthen the diffusion and the analysis of information in the markets. The issues paper calls attention to market failures in this regard leading up to the euro crisis. In particular, noted the failure of spreads to reflect credit risks. There are two key private services that supply and process important information in the markets, and they are the audit firms and the ratings agencies. Both have contributed to recent crises. You can think Enron, you can think AAA CDOs in the Caymans. The core problem here is that these services are funded by the businesses themselves being audited or rated. I think this tends to skew the incentives, and it can damage the integrity of what's out in the market, and we need to look at other funding models. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Well, Jeffrey, I give you the floor now for comments.
Well, thank you. I think Paul has given a very thoughtful presentation on some of the specific issues involved in micro-prudential surveillance. I'm going to go in a very different direction, which I think is complementary to what Paul's done, and talk about how the overall process of micro-surveillance fits into the broader surveillance picture. The financial crises in the advanced economies over the past 6 years have rightly focused our attention on failures of financial supervision and regulation. But the results of this focus have not always been constructive, and I think Paul's indicated some of the ways in which they haven't, in reducing systemic risk while fostering the development of financial markets to meet the needs of an increasingly complex and interconnected global economy. So I'm going to outline what we should and should not expect microprudential to do. My comments draw mainly on what has happened in the U.S. economy, because this is what I've looked at most closely. In fact, I recently completed a paper on how the crisis took place in the U.S., which I've got some copies of, which I'd be glad to share with you afterwards. But those of you who know Europe better than I do can quickly, I think, draw parallels and contrasts with what I'm going to say. I want to go back to March of 2008, when the U.S. Treasury published a blueprint for modernized financial regulatory structure. And the work that went into this had been done well before the full impact of the subprime crisis had been felt, and it was kind of an independent of time rethink of how we should treat regulation. And I thought at the time it was very sound, and I still think so. So I want to highlight the three regulatory functions that are identified in that paper. One is market stability regulation to address the overall conditions of financial market stability that could impact the real economy. The second is prudential financial regulation to address the issues of limited market discipline caused by government guarantees. That's what I think of as microprudential. And I think it's important to recognize these two are seen as complementary, and they're not the same thing, and I'm going to talk about some of the ways in which they're different. And the third is business conduct regulation, including consumer protection regulation, to address standards for business practices, also including insider trading and other market practices. The first of these highlights the macroprudential oversight needs that were not met before the crisis. And as I said, the second is microprudential. With what we saw in the crisis, I would take a somewhat broader view of the market failures to be addressed by microprudential than just moral hazard. There were clear governance failures in financial institutions that led to excessive risk-taking in the run-up to the last crisis. But the distortion of incentives from explicit and implicit government guarantees can be costly to the government and systemically damaging if they're not contained. There was once a view expressed by Walter Wriston, who was then CEO of Citigroup 30 years ago, the banks no longer needed high levels of capital as long as they were profitable, well-managed, and growing. And he pointed to market signals of confidence in banking without acknowledging the role that the government as a backstop was playing in shaping those distorted signals. And I think that was a fundamental misperception at that time that some people on Wall Street still have. On the third function, I think we should note that failure here has also contributed to the systemic crisis. When abusive mortgage practices and fraud and documentation went unchecked, risk built up in the mortgage market, and I am pleased that we have strengthened that in the U.S. under Dodd-Frank. Reflecting, though, the moral hazard concerns, which is the heart of the subject for this session, prudential regulation has as its core capital adequacy, and Paul has talked about some of the deficiencies in that. You do have to assess not just capital, but how you assess the risks really matters. It goes beyond credit risk, market risk that Paul focused on, and also operational risk. It also means assessing exposure to liquidity stresses, something that was almost totally neglected before the U.S. crisis, and it led to a capital destruction that multiplied the losses in the housing market. And what we experienced was a much greater downturn than one would have predicted from looking at the overvaluation of housing in the U.S. in 2007. Liquidity had been virtually ignored as a risk outside banks and wasn't well supervised in banks before the crisis, partly because the objective of micro-supervision is to ensure the safety and soundness of individual institutions to protect taxpayer interest, and it's partly because the SEC did not take capital adequacy and liquidity risk as important under its mandate. And when market liquidity evaporated and institutions that had counted on liquidity provided by markets, they couldn't survive without assistance, the taxpayer was put at risk when liquidity was provided by the Fed, and the global economy was damaged when it was not, in the case of Lehman Brothers' failure. Some seem to be intent on raising capital standards enough to absorb any conceivable market liquidity risk. This is part of what I think Paul is saying. I think this will only feed shadow market banking competition. It's at least as important to reduce exposure to market liquidity risk and throughout the system, and not just the core institutions, and to lower that risk in the system. There were four systemic failures that contributed to systemic risk, I think, before the crisis. One, microprudential supervision, it put the emphasis on diversification. And the hallmark of a systemic crisis is the correlations increase dramatically. The gains from diversification disappear. So I do disagree a little bit about from Paul and his saying, well, we could should allow maybe more for diversification in this area. Second, regulators get caught up in the hope, complacency, and optimism that allow imbalances to build up in the financial institutions and other policy objectives impinge on risk. So we had a system in which mortgages got low risk weights before the crisis, and sovereign lending still gets treated as riskless when it's not. So I think these problems reflect politics and human nature and are still going to be with us. As noted, the third problem was that liquidity was poorly dealt with, in part because regulatory criteria had lagged behind changing market practices. And fourth, the focus on compensating for moral hazard created by government guarantees has left systemic risk to grow out of sight of the prudential regulators, where formal government support was not present. The first two of these shortcomings should be attacked, but we've got to be realistic about whether they can be corrected. As for the third, the liquidity ratios mandated by Dodd-Frank do go in the right direction, but they don't provide full comfort that we'll avoid another meltdown. Closer regulation of the liquidity of individual institutions can go some way towards creating a more stable system, but the fundamental problem is one of how the system functions under stress, not what ratios are applied to individual institutions. The fourth weakness of prudential regulation was the fatal systemic flaw. The center of the liquidity meltdown in the U.S. was not in banks, but in non-banks. The asset-backed commercial paper market, the sieves, the structured investment vehicles, and other conduits that they funded, in Bear Stearns, in Lehman Brothers, in AIG, and in the money market mutual funds. The SEC, which was responsible for regulating all of these except AIG, cared little about safety and soundness so long as rules written by lawyers were being followed. AIG was subject to no meaningful oversight. 5 years after Lehman's bankruptcy, one thing has changed. The remaining large broker-dealers, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, have become bank holding companies subject to the Federal Reserve's oversight. But the system is still vulnerable to weak institutions outside the prudential net. The failure of the SEC to take adequate action to ensure the viability of money market mutual funds in distressed markets is, I think, a sad case of continuing regulatory failure. In addition, institutions outside the bank holding company net are well placed to grow. And we have seen the failure of one that pursued a growth aggressively, MF Global, which sent some reverberations through the system and underscore this problem. I think we should be prepared for more surprises like this. Higher capital requirements on banks will favor shadow banks even more in the future. Hedge funds are also lightly regulated, although risk management by their counterparties, pressed by the Fed, has limited their liquidity vulnerability to levels well below those that prevailed when long-term capital management had to be rescued in 1998. The effectiveness of the framework for monitoring systemic risk established by Dodd-Frank will be most important for systemic stability. A Financial Stability Oversight Council was established along with an Office of Financial Research to provide analytical support. And this arrangement is not ideal, but the fragmented U.S. financial regulatory structure already has too much room for turf wars and for problems to fall through the regulatory tracks. Microprudential oversight, even if systemically focused, can support the Oversight Council in important ways. And it is important to have the flow of information from the micro to the macro in order for this to work. I think one example recently is the new focus in the U.S. on the commodities activities of banks, which was originally a concern that the micro supervisors saw and has become a broader debate. I think stronger individual institutions resulting from better microprudential supervision is going to go some way to create a sounder system. It's far from sufficient. And I think we not only need strong systemic view, I think we also have to be prepared to maintain a strong fire brigade and a crisis fighting system, because we haven't seen the last one. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey. The financial crisis, and maybe even the debt crisis, shown how difficult it was to measure the risk. The
yes.
risk of products and the risk of companies. Therefore, I'm sure you will shed some light on that.
Yes, thank you very much, Chairman, and thank you, everyone. I have the pleasure of representing the rating agency, so I'm with distinguished economists, but I certainly come from a different angle. And I wanted to obviously focus on why weren't some of the warnings identified at the time, pre-crisis, and also work on a question that Professor Shigehara asked, which was, how can we ensure that capital market will be forward-looking and not avoid abrupt changes of market conditions? We'll see if that's something that is conceivable. So on the warnings, I think, you know, as was mentioned by some of my predecessors, as a rating agency, we assess credit risk. And I've been in the business for many years, and in the years 2005, I had lots of people telling me, oh, you're soon out of business. Risks has disappeared. The question of credit risk was something that at the time was totally ignored. And when you're in the business of doing credit risk, it was extremely difficult to get our message heard. Especially, and obviously I'm based in Europe, so I know the Europe crisis intimately, I would say, and there are several reasons for this. Firstly, it was mentioned, you know, investors don't look only at credit risk, they look at liquidity, and the spreads do not only reflect this credit risk, and that's often misunderstood. So the signals that rating agencies, S&P in particular, were given regarding the Eurozone in particular were absolutely not audible at the time because there was this perception, and I think it's been mentioned at the first table, that the European construction was absolute and was fully integrated, and convergence of interest rates created the bubbles that we know now. And at the time, time all the rating changes that started happening in the years 2004-2005 only started to resonate starting 2009, and then effectively the reaction of the markets that had been fully ignorant of the signals went all the way up in the other opposite direction and with the excess. Some of the root cause of this, and Mr. Atkinson has focused on it, is clearly some of the banking regulation, and especially the fact that a sovereign risk was and still is slightly is considered riskless. If you look at, I mean, some of the issues in the European banks is that they hold tremendous amount of debt of their sovereigns, and then creating the circle, as we know. So how to address that? Clearly, regulation and some of the regulatory changes move toward reducing the systemic risk. And so I don't want to repeat some of the points that have been mentioned. But clearly, from our standpoint as a rating agency, we're fully supportive also of the fact of reducing systemic reliance on ratings. You probably know that the whole architecture, especially Basel II, was largely linked to triggers linked to ratings. And this created two things. Firstly, it created systemic risk when, you know, some of those triggers were reached, but also it disincentivized market participants to do their own credit analysis. And that's really, in our standpoint, at some of the root cause of the situation we're in. Regulators throughout the world, these are G20 initiatives, advocate, and we're supportive of that, to remove those rating from regulation, or at least add additional measures. However, you know, it is clear that this shift from a world where market participants were just looking at a couple of flags, ratings in this case, to a full analysis of the underlying risk is going to be painful and a long process. Now, let me move away from ratings and start discussing something that I think hasn't been addressed in this by my colleagues at this table, is around transparency and comparability. What we see is obviously lots of efforts around disclosure and the fact that investors are looking for data. They want to understand, you know, what is the underlying risk of the exposure they're taking. And what is symptomatic is that there are many efforts, especially under Basel Committee, to really improve the disclosure levels to ensure this global comparability. Let me give you an example. If you want to look at what is, let's say, the real estate mortgage portfolio of banks in the world and the level of non-performing assets, it seems something very simple. You would expect to see that in every bank. If you try to do this exercise, you'll realize how much beyond the umbrella of, you know, comparability every domestic national regulator then allows for different disclosure levels. And then you're back to square one, and this lack of confidence that investors have in the underlying disclosures is also at the root cause of some of the fragmentation that we're seeing currently in Europe. Clearly, and I'll finish by that, I wanted to share some views on the European banking. There are lots of discussions around, you know, will this European banking take place? We believe at S&P that it's going to be a very long process, but the foundations are gradually being put in place. The supervision under the ECB is going, obviously, to have its first highlight with the asset quality review, which will speak to this ability to compare risk. So everyone is very eager to see how it will happen and whether political consideration will or will not alter this analysis. However, we're conscious that, you know, this is a long path and that Europeans are obviously committed to build something. Nevertheless, and I may finish by that, and maybe it was De Schaeffer may have slightly diverging views, the banking sector is critical for European economies, and this is where it differs from the US, which is much more of a capital market funded economies, and hence the ability to fully disconnect the banking risk from the sovereign risk is probably something that is going to take a while, if ever will we get there. Because when you start looking at the architecture, yes, the surveillance, the supervision has been transferred at the European level. But macroprudential supervision will remain local. Consumer protection, housing markets regulation will continue until in the foreseeable future to still be at the country level. So a lot is in progress. There are some very good, important avenues that have been explored, both on the at the global level on regulation, as well as in the European Union to address some of this fragmentation. However, this is a long process, and I think we all kind of say the same thing, is that there are different actors and also lots of behavioral change that will have to be considered before, in order to prepare ourselves, hopefully, for the next crisis, not the past crisis. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Maybe one question from the floor. We have not much time left. Any question on these difficult matters? Because it's fairly technical also. And you have to deal with markets which are volatile. Therefore, I have always some skepticism about the possibility to apply good regulations to that. Yes, please. Only question. Only one question. Please.
My name is John Thompson. I work as an independent consultant, but previously I was a financial counselor at OECD. I guess the first question would be to, well, this is really one interconnected mostly to Paul Atkinson. The proposal you're making for a simplified capital requirement, how would that differ from going back, say, to Basel I? Because you made it more complicated in Basel II, it's getting even more in Basel III. Maybe Basel I wasn't that bad.
John, Basel I is at the origin of the risk weight system. You have four risks. I would say there is no fundamental difference between what you've got and Basel I. Basel I was 13 pages long. An ordinary numerate person could read it from here to the airport in a taxi and understand it. But the fundamentals and the explosion of complexity that has happened since, and I, for time purposes, I dropped a slide on precisely this issue. It has exploded in terms of complexity. You have millions of risk weights potentially. Millions of calculations are involved for the big banks doing this. But it's all just the proliferation of different classifications and different categories. The whole approach is you just slice and dice everything you can think of, and you start listing them all, and then you have a capital backing for each one, and then you add them up.
We have no time left for more questions. One only, and the last one. Yes.
This one's here. My question would be to Jeffrey and someone.
Are you concerned about the explosion of regulation as opposed to principles that are basically governing too much of our system? I mean, we have Sarbanes-Oxley, which is brought in, you know, public protest. We have to have Sarbanes-Oxley. It induced many companies. You're trying to take companies public. Some of them went private because they simply can't afford Sarbanes-Oxley, some of the solvents that are on NASDAQ, for example. Now you have Dodd-Frank. I mean, where is this going to end, and when can we get back to some principles, as we did, by the way, the OECD with the principles of corporate governance. I mean, we said the regulation we leave to governments. These are the principles. If you're outside the principle, you don't escape. But the way this is operating, if you can get inside the rule, no matter how immoral or whatever else it may be, you're okay. Now, Jeffrey, is there any Am I being naive, or is there any possibility that someday we might get back to principles of transparency, fiduciary principles, and so on, rather than this incredible nightmare we're creating? For my own profession, it's great, but for the world at large, it's terrible.
Thank you. This is more or less a question raised by Jean-Jacques Perkel previously. He could not get an answer about over-regulation.
I might say, Don, you're part of the problem. If I remember correctly, you're trained as a lawyer, right? And the problem... And you've gone beyond that. But there is a legal approach to dealing with problems, which is if you can write a rule, that will get you the right behavior, which I think has been shown in financial markets to fail over and over again. And it's partly implicit in my contrasting of the SEC approach to the Fed's approach, which, although it has to live within the rules, is still more kind of analytically rooted. But I think it is a problem we're going to live with for a long time, it's one of the reasons why I say we've got to keep the firefighting machinery sound.
Thank you. We are over time now. Thank you. Therefore, I stop. Oh, one. Kumi says one more. You don't. Philip.
No, I just want to say.
You are coming here.
Just one very brief word
in defense of the Bible.
We looked at this in the annual report. We looked at what predicts banking crises better. And the answer is, it's not risk-weighted assets alone. It's not a simple leverage ratio alone. It's both together. And the difficulty of the regulation is to try to combine these two elements in a way that the people understand.
Okay, thank you. This session is over. You want the floor? No. No. You have spoken enough. Philippe, the floor is yours
now.
Session 3. Well, this is a French improvisation. The plates are not ready yet, but you know the speakers.
Thank you. No, it's just the two of us, because the other people were not able to come. Okay, shall we understand? How does it switch on? It's already on. Okay? Okay, shall we start in a few seconds? Let me first of all start by thanking Kumi Shigehara for bringing together this conference. It took a lot of energy to do so. I think all of us are very grateful to him, and also to Robert Raymond for graciously organizing and hosting us in this wonderful room. The title of the session is Macroprudential and Monetary Policy Management. And the key question is, how can these policies be used to secure financial market and macroeconomic stability? Key question came up this morning, it's very clear in André Carle's paper, that the euro crisis reflected excessive private sector debt as much as fiscal policy problems. The euro area imposed a common monetary policy. It was probably about right for Germany, but it was much too slack for Spain, Ireland and for others. Now, we have an excellent analytical article by Adrian Blundell-Wignall on what macroprudential policies can achieve. And before passing the floor to him, let me summarise papers by Stephen Axelrod and Charles Goodhart, who were unable to join us. Both of them, I think, have written very interesting papers that raise many issues that go well beyond the topic of this conference. Three questions. You might think about these questions for discussion afterwards. One, is it realistic for macroprudential policies to fill the void left by the absence of independent monetary policy at a national level? The second question, should macroprudential policies be set by national central banks or by the ECB? And how should any form of euro area coordination of regulation be organised? Third point is, can macroprudential policies be used to ease borrowing constraints in a downturn, not just tighten borrowing constraints to head off a boom, but can it be used to ease borrowing constraints in downturn? On the first question, the use of macroprudential policies to fill the void created by the lack of independent national monetary policies, I think most economists would say no. Interest rates, we heard this morning, are very important. They affect all decisions. And I think this is what Steve Axelrod is saying in his paper. His answer is really no, except in a financial crisis. He begins by arguing that monetary policy and regulatory policy are distinct. They don't normally interact. He says he knows of no case of changes in bank capital requirements that have been implemented to take place of a tightening or easing of monetary policy. If a tightening or easing of monetary policy is required, it's almost always better to do that and not to allow to rely on some second-best movement of a regulatory variable. It's only in a crisis, he said, that monetary policy is forced to devote its full attention to stabilising the financial system. In a crisis, he explains, the central bank in effect becomes the continuing provider of credit to the market. This is what the massive balance sheet expansion the Federal Reserve amounts to. Purchase of bonds on a huge scale was aimed to achieve this. The ECB's LTRO removed liquidity risk from Europe's banks and made it easier for governments in some countries to sell their bonds. Charles Goodhart, in a different article that Adrian cites, says that the central bank's balance sheet should be its first macroprudential tool. So the central bank has its own balance sheet as a macroprudential tool. Of course, the problem is the ECB has often had to step in because euro area governments couldn't themselves agree on what to do. An additional difficulty is that national central banks in the euro area don't agree on what the ECB should buy. The Bundesbank has been outvoted on a number of occasions. Axelrod goes on to stress two key differences between regulatory and monetary policy. First, regulatory policy is slower. Regulators have to negotiate agreements that deal with complex interrelationships in business, between markets, institutions, domestic and international. They have to consult, and they have to offer some form of due process to those that are regulating. On the other hand, interest rates can be changed overnight. Second difference, regulation raises questions that are overtly political. Fairness, access to credit, discrimination between countries, these questions become much clearer than they do in monetary policy. So Axelrod is sceptical of achieving an operational integration of monetary and regulatory policies in Europe. The political and regulatory structure, he says, is just too decentralised. Even within one country, the banking and market regulators or securities regulators have often very different policy orientations. So on question two, then he's sceptical about the coordination of regulation within the euro area. Nevertheless, he says, European governments must recognise, quote, the crucial interest of and some role for the ECB in the regulatory process. He doesn't go as far as saying the ECB should be the single supervisor, however. And at present, the ECB has a say on macroprudential policies that are proposed at a national level, and whether this actually impedes effective decentralisation that macroprudential policies require remains to be seen. Now, one response to the difficulty of coordinating national supervisory authorities in Europe globally is to put less weight on supervision and regulation and more weight on influencing the incentives affecting bank managers. And this is what Charles Goodhart proposes. Decisions, he says, are taken by human beings, not by inanimate institutions. Limited liability and remuneration packages encourage them to maximise the rate of return of equity and pay little attention to the risk of going broke. So Charles would like to reform remuneration packages of top managers to make them, and not the taxpayer, pay more in the case of a low probability but high cost disaster. He doesn't want the bank managers to take the goodies when things are going well and then simply walk away when the bank fails. So he would like banks to become less leveraged. He talks of a risk-weighted ratio of 20%. Current Basel 1 is 7%. And a leverage ratio of 10%. And the current Basel proposal is 3%. Now, the practical way of achieving this, he says, he's rather sceptical of getting political agreement on changing compensation packages, is to follow the US TARP process. You require banks to hold an absolute level, not ratio, of capital. So in the asset quality review in the euro area, you would decide what level of equity each bank should hold. Then, second point, the state would inject capital to cover shortfalls, and it would do so on terms that are adverse to the banks. on terms the banks don't like, but are favourable to the taxpayer. Of course, in Europe, there's an additional dimension which he doesn't go into, is which state. Would it be better for Europe as a whole to take equity exposures to European banks, or should the national government take equity exposure to its own bank? Third, limit dividends until the shortfall of equity is made good. He criticises Europe's current approach. He says by imposing an immediate increase in the required equity ratio, not the level of equity, but the ratio of equity to the bank's total assets, is bound to force banks to deleverage, is bound to force them to reduce lending, to reduce the level of their assets. And faced with this, the monetary authorities in each euro country are insisting that banks in their country don't cut back on lending in their own country. But of course, it's okay to cut back on lending abroad. And you see a very clear warning of Charles, quote, cross-border banking in Europe is shriveling, leading to a fragmentation of European banking systems back into national enclaves. Final third question, not much to be said on it, it's only touched upon. Question is, can macroprudential policies be more symmetric? Can they be used to ease borrowing constraints when macroeconomic conditions are actually very poor, and often when the financial risks in the long term from greater lending may not be so great? It's clearly important that macroprudential should be used in a symmetric way. It should be possible to ease policy. It should be possible to get banks to lend more in conditions of economic weakness. But this is very, very difficult. Charles argues one way of dealing with this is to have a larger gap between the desirable equity ratio, this is the risk-weighted assets of 7% at present, and the minimum ratio a bank must maintain in order to avoid supervisory intervention. At the moment, this minimum is 4.5%. So there's a capital conservation buffer of around 2.5%. And in Charles's view, this is much too small. You need a much bigger gap between the level of capital a bank should build up in good times, and you should be much more tolerant of their ability to run it down to a lower level in difficult conditions, a much wider capital conservation buffer. So that his recommendation, it's not a recommendation for today when conditions are very difficult, but his recommendations over the medium term is that European banks and their regulators should strive to achieve higher levels of capital, both risk-weighted measures and on a leverage ratio, to give them more fat, more of a buffer to absorb in difficult economic conditions. So thank you. I've tried to summarise the points that are from Charles's paper and from Steve Axelrod's paper that seem to have most relevant bearing to our topic. But let me now give the floor to Adrian.
Thanks, Philip. And, nice to see so many old faces in the room that I remember and worked with over the years. It's a great pleasure. The topic is, with me, when you're dealing with me, it's really going to be a bit allocated towards those who are a little bit more technical, because I believe that this is too hard if you don't go into the facts. And I suppose you'll see in my paper and the way I'll approach this is that for too long now we've been making policy on the run. People just come along, there's a crisis, you've got to handle the crisis, so let's do this, let's do that, this didn't work. And so people start doing things. And of course, time goes on and we evolve in the way Paul described. I think one of the old professors at Cambridge where I was, Joan Robinson, once said that a map on a one-to-one scale is no good to anybody. And that's the way Basel is evolving. You know, if it moves, put a rule on it. And so we're just getting these thousands of pages that Paul referred to. So my role isn't to talk about the micro, but the macro. But I want to make it really clear that under this Basel III, that many of the things, and in fact, Charles Goodhart, who we've just heard a summary of, what was called the Geneva Report, has been quite, influential in many of the things which is in Basel III, preparing the way for a lot of counter-cyclical macro-prudential type of policy. And of course, I'll sort of come back to that point. I think the term macroprudential, well, as you can see in the slide, it goes back to the Cross Committee, I think, is one of the first times that it was... I think everybody knows what that says. I'll speak more slowly. The Cross Committee in 1986, which I remember reading as a younger fellow, it mentions it there. I think one of the main was Crockett in 2000, who you can see the 2 points there about pro-cyclicality, counter-cyclical buffers, which, as I say, is becoming a part of the Basel sort of way to think about it in Basel, and the connected institutions. The Cross Committee, if you read that again, it's actually fascinating because all the things they spoke about in that, which was really quite brilliant, came to pass. But the Basel Committee, the people who sort of were at the head of that, this Cross Committee came, and the Basel Committee was there, BCBS doing everything. Everything that Cross Committee report says came to be true, but they didn't do anything about it. The whole policy framework didn't really address that. I think Crockett gave a pretty good summary, but then the FSD, which I attend in 2011, came with the idea that defining macroprudential as the uses of prudential tools to limit systemic or system-wide financial risk. And I think that's where the problem really starts, because it becomes very prescriptive. There are four key requirements to be able to do macroprudential policy. Number one is you've got to be able to identify the imbalance before it becomes a problem. Now, the record on this is just appalling, and I think we've heard just about every speaker before saying nobody saw this crisis coming. I can tell you that's my view too. Even the Basel process, Basel II comes along. I mean, Basel II, just before the crisis, is cutting capital that banks had to hold just before a major crisis is going to come about. I mean, in all of my work as a policymaker, I don't think I've ever come across such a big Led Zeppelin as that, that you'd be cutting huge cuts in capital just prior to a major crisis. And then I remember my first FSB meeting in March 2007. We had Timothy Geithner and all these famous people there, and they were talking about, that if there was going to be a crisis, it was going to come from hedge funds and private equity funds, and not from the regulated sector. And I remember sitting there, having just come from Citigroup, and saying, I wonder how many when they're going to first mention the word structured products. And the number of times structured products was mentioned in that meeting was exactly equal to zero. So they had no idea. So my feeling on the first point is no chance. But nevertheless, that's what you have to do. Select the appropriate tools, decide how to calibrate them, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that, and then coordinate everybody. There's lots of tools here. I won't go through them all, but the ones here, the tools for balance sheets, and these are the sort of things that you'll read about in Basel. The possibility to use those tools there for the balance sheet. There's a whole lot of others. Loan to value ratios are often mentioned and so on. I don't want to give the impression that I have no time for this. I do have time for it, but my basic point is going to be that if you're going to do macroprudential policy, you better have the structure of the financial system in the right shape to be able to do it. Because if you don't, you're going to be playing around and pushing things one way, and it'll just cause problems in other ways, which has always been the problem. Because when you think about it, if you think about the process of regulation, deregulation, and so on, in the bad old days when I first started off as an economist, monetary policy was thought about in a macroprudential policy kind of way. It was about sectoral things. You were running sectoral monetary policy. So you had interest rate ceilings and you had credit ceilings and you were focused on this. You had special reserve requirements, all of these kind of things. And so these young people coming up with these, new macroprudential tools, it's like, we're going back to what we had back in the 60s and 70s is the sort of thing that's being proposed here. So we're going back to a sectoral approach to monetary policy, i.e. macroprudential plus monetary policy. So now I come to the little bit more technical part, and I think here, this is the point I've been saying many times in various meetings, is that I'm getting really, I think it's time to stop now saying this is, you know, this is regulations and the process of how it works. The process, the way that it works, is that regulators propose something because they're dealing with something on the run, then they put it out for discussion, and then the banks come back with their armies of rocket scientists and so on and say, you know, no. If you do that, you have no idea what you're doing. You're going to destroy the world as we know it, et cetera. And, of course, politicians are like, oh, my God, you know, we're going to destroy the world. We better back off here. And so they do. So our view is that let's stop now. Let's change the debate. The OECD is basically in the forefront of this. And it's very clear for me when I go to these SCAV meetings for the FSB that nobody has actually done the work on what causes a bank to have risk. Nobody's done that work. We started to do it. My young assistant, Carolyn Rulle, is in the back of the room. And she's one of the ones who's been helping me massively with this. I just thought I'd mention her. But what we do is we start off with the concept, okay, let's measure the riskiness of a bank. Let's not talk about whether banks are risky or not, and because banks are, they hide everything, and we've heard a lot about that today. So let's actually measure the thing called the distance to default of a bank. So the distance to default of a bank takes the market value of the bank's assets, I'll come back to that, and compares it to the book value of the liabilities. Because when the market value of the assets goes through or equal to the book value of the liabilities, then the bank is at the default point, and if it goes below that, then you've got negative equity, you're in default. So, but of course you can't observe the market value of the bank's assets, because they don't want to, certainly don't want to tell you what they are. That's one of the big problems in Europe at the moment, is that banks have got all these hidden problems in their banking books, you know, things that are valued very differently. And so we see these things time and time and time again. You know, a bank comes out, oh, we've got another little write down here, because you only find out what the value of an asset is when it actually matures and you see what its recovery value is. So we use the Black-Scholes formula to calculate the market value of the bank's assets, and we compare that to and we do this for every individual bank. So, and you can observe this almost on a daily basis. And let me tell you, it was very, very good. Just to give you an example, 2 years before Dexia failed, the distance to default of Dexia in our model was collapsing. If you look at the credit default swaps, you'll see there was no sign of that really. Even in the credit default swap market, there was no real sign of this happening. But 2 years later, of course, Dexia failed. This distance to default measure was a very, very good predictor, especially in Europe. In the US, credit default swaps and the distance to default sort of pretty similar in terms of their timing. It's a deeper, more liquid market. So we measure this. And you can see there straight away there's a problem in Europe, and we've heard a lot about that today. And, of course, every one of those numbers down the bottom there refers to a bank, and distance to default is measured in standard deviations. So 2 means that you've got a 5% chance of failing, which is way too high for a major financial institution. So we say, well, you should try to aim for a distance to default of 3 standard deviations away from the default point. Then you're a reasonably safe bank. You can see that most of the American banks are now meeting that category. But within Europe, they're all down there in the 2 sort of area and some below the 2 sort of area. And the further south you go, the bigger the problem gets, so without naming names. Now, this is just, I'm sorry about this, but I just want to focus on a couple of things here, because what we do is we basically look at the determinants of the distance to default. And I'll just sum this up for you very quickly without, you know, you don't have to be an econometrician. If you just have a look at the first column for all banks, a large sample of banks, you can see there the leverage ratio, LEV, is very, very important. The 3 stars means very, very significant with the right sign. You can see that when we put the Basel Tier 1 ratio in there, nothing. The Basel Tier 1 ratio, this is what I'm talking about, the facts. Let's get the facts straight. The Basel Tier 1 ratio is uncorrelated with the distance to default of banks. There is no correlation. The leverage ratio, on our definition of it, the one Paul mentioned, where we don't allow for derivative netting, is highly correlated with the distance to default. So the leverage ratio is what matters. Then we come to the business model features, which is, I'll just focus on 3 of these, and the very bottom one, house price index, because therein lies the way in for macroprudential policy. You can see there, first of all, the housing price cycle is always and everywhere a very big influence on the distance to default. But there are 3 business model features there that come out really strongly in this work. Number one, Paul mentioned it, the gross market value of derivatives. It's extremely important. If that's very high in a bank's balance sheet, you are going to be a risky bank. Wholesale funding, if that's very high in a bank, you are going to be, the distance of hold is going to go down. But interestingly, if you've got the securities, trading securities, that's very positively related. Now, if I can just come to the macro prudential part of this. So we're thinking about, okay, if we just put those variables that the and I'm trying to make this as simple as I can, if we put those variables that the model says that these are the things that matter for the riskiness of banks, what are they? Leverage, house prices, and derivatives, wholesale funding, and your trading security, which has a positive. The higher your trading securities, the safer you are, because you've got, if you get a margin call, you've got something you can sell easily. That's the logic, that's the intuition of it. So we just put those in there, and we put them against three monetary policy type variables, plus the change in the little percent T1 there is the change in the tier one ratio, which would be like a buffer. So if the tier one ratio is not correlated with the distance to default, but actually is correlated with something else. If you look down the column that says tier one, you'll see there that it has that change. If you can change the amount of capital just as a change variable rather than a level variable, you can see that actually it is, if you look at the house price index, a zero underneath those numbers means highly significant. You can see that it is negatively correlated with the house price index. So if you raise the tier one ratio, that is going to damp down the house price index. But I want you also to look at a couple of other things there because of the complexity of the system. And that is that if you look down that tier one ratio, you'll see that it is positively correlated, highly significantly positively correlated with the gross market value of derivatives. So here you are. You're coming in, say, with a macroprudential policy rule that says, let's have a capital buffer, let's raise the capital requirement to help damp the house price index, and you'll say, okay, well, then what does that do? It does a couple of other things there. If you look down that column, you'll see, well, it does damp the house price index, but it raises the gross market value of derivatives. Why? Because when you try to impose these things, that's exactly what banks do. That's exactly what Paul was talking about. And you see there in these simple correlations, it comes out straight away. Banks will then start to use derivatives to shift into the shadow banking sector, and they will then get their CVA desk working and so on to make sure they don't have to have capital charges. And so as you try to raise the capital through that mechanism, you'll see the gross market value of derivatives goes up, but we know that that's a negative. That's a negative for the bank safety. So on the one hand, you're doing something which is going to damp the housing cycle, which you said, well, that's a good thing. You're leaning into the wind. But on the other hand, you're going to cause banks to push into derivatives. And the other thing you see there is a negative correlation with the monetary policy variables. And therein lies another danger with macroprudential, which is that people will come to think that it's a substitute for monetary policy, that, well, you know, we don't have to really take a tough decision in monetary policy, because if we do this macroprudential thing here, that's a substitute for monetary policy. So, in my view, then I won't try to go too much more into that. But you do see there that monetary policy, if you go along the row where it says, you know, the change in the 10-year bond rate, or the change in the three-month interest rate, or just the change in central bank money, the liabilities of the major central banks in the world, you see there that they have the correct sign with respect to a leaning into the wind policy. You see that when house prices are rising, that's positively correlated with interest rates. So monetary policy is actually leaning into the wind, but there is a bit of a risk here that if you start to substitute macroprudential, you regard that as a substitute for it. And I think my own view would be that monetary policy is the key thing. So our view then is that imagine that you're not a bank that does derivatives. You're not one of these G-SIFIs that Paul spoke about. So you're not a bank that's doing that. Then if you're not a bank that's doing that and you have a counter-cyclical capital rule, then obviously you're not going to be a bank which is going to be pushing stuff into the shadow banking sector to the same extent as a Citigroup or a Morgan Stanley or a UBS or a Credit Suisse or a BNP Paribas or a Deutsche Bank, because that's not their business. They're not doing that. So if you can separate off those institutions and say, okay, how do we take these institutions which combine traditional deposit banking with these prime broking businesses, if we can separate off the prime broking part of the business and leave them as a core deposit-taking bank, like other traditional banks, then macroprudential policy will work quite well for those. And then you're left with the question of, well, what about the separated specialist investment banks, prime broking sort of securities companies, what happens to them? And I think Paul's already mentioned, and I'll coming to the end of this, I've got this slide up here. One time I put this slide there because a few years ago I was coming home from work at the OECD and I was sitting down making my curry and waiting for the football match to start on television, and this shouting started down in the street below, and we were told to all come down and so on because the apartment building next door was exactly beginning to look like that. And I remember standing out there in the street thinking, oh my God, I hope the party walls, or those, you know, the security walls for fire are going to be good. Otherwise, all my suits and all my possessions are all going to be destroyed. And of course, luckily for me, the party walls were very good. And that's our view here, that if you have what we call a non-operating holding company structure, which is for these big universal banks, we essentially, there's a parent. The parent can invest in subsidiaries. It's where the equity gets raised. It can invest in subsidiaries, a core deposit banking institution, and anything else that it wants to do, especially its prime broking investment banking businesses. They become separate. In my view, they shouldn't be banks. They should be like the US investment banks were before they all became banks, so they could get all the handouts that came with being a bank. But if you do that, then you have a completely different system. You have a system where you have traditional banking, the core deposit banking, and our view is just looking at banks and what they do. I think Paul had up on his chart there Wells Fargo, which is, I was seeing one of the chief global corporate governance persons from Deutsche Bank the other day, and I said, and for us, the safest bank in the world, and she took the words out of my mouth and said, Wells Fargo, and I said, yes. And Wells Fargo, you know, here's a bank which is a very large, very profitable bank. Do you know what its leverage is? 13 times compared to a Deutsche Bank. You know, Paul put up 60, but depending on how you measure capital, between 45 and 60, some of these big banks around Europe and in the US have huge leverage. Wells Fargo, 13 times, 7.8% gross market value of derivatives in its portfolio. You need that to do your own hedging and so on. And so our view is if you separate that off, you'll have a... am I coming to the end?
Yes.
Yep.
Beyond the end.
I am at the end. Let me just quickly switch then to the capital controls part of it, because the other part of this paper is a lot of developing countries, which we also look at, believe that that you can use macroprudential policy really helps in running in crisis periods especially. And the IMF I heard the IMF getting some very just comments made earlier today, and I 100% agree with them. The IMF put out this study very recently, which every developing market in the world is quoting, as Ostri et al., saying that that capital controls help countries in crisis periods to reconcile their because they've got monetary inflows coming in when in the good periods, and you've got the periods of the crisis comes along. It helps them manage their in both cases it helps them manage their situation, but especially in crises. We had a look at that study, we reproduced it exactly, and we found out that actually there's no basis to this study that one would want to put any faith in. So we did our own version of it, just using panel regression work, and we found something quite different. And that is that these macroprudential capital rules actually do help emerging markets in the good times when money's flowing into these countries. Why is that the case? It's really about exchange rate management. It helps them stop the exchange rate going up. They intervene less because of the capital controls, and therefore their printing money is less. And the companies in these good times in those countries, they have plenty of cash flow. Plenty of cash flow. But when the bad times come, like now in some of these emerging countries, and the money's going out the other way, then something different happens in the results. Then we find that instead of being a positive support for GDP, it becomes a very big, significant negative. And you can see the reasons why. Because there's no benefit in targeting the exchange rate when the exchange rate wants to go down anyway. Secondly, credit is contracting because intervention's going the opposite way. And thirdly, the cash flow of these companies, because you're heading towards a recession, is no good. And so in that environment, you want capital to flow in, But who wants to put money in a crisis in a place where you might not be able to get it out? So we find it very big negative. And so we don't support the idea of our capital controls for macroprudential in emerging markets either. And I know Philip is looking at me, so I'll stop there.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Adrian. Yes. Two-hander.
Your time of default measure
can derive from
the equity prices.
Your time to default measure is derived from the equity prices of the. Is that correct?
It uses the stock market information, particularly the volatility of the stock of the individual banks.
But it is derived from the equity price.
Which is why it does better than the credit default swap, because that's a bigger, deeper market than the credit default swaps, which are easily manipulated. Which is.
And credit default swaps have moral hazard.
Thank you. As I said in the previous session, I think the idea of a supervisory system based on a simple leverage ratio would actually, I suspect, be very difficult to implement and would push a lot of risks outside the banking system. I think one issue which is really the core of this question is in the unconstrained use of banks' own models to measure risk. And if there were one mistake that Basel II made was that it gave too much credibility to banks' own risk models. And you can understand why this happens, because if you're a regulator, you go into a bank that's got a highly sophisticated modelling system and you say, well, explain to me your risk exposures, it's very easy for the bank to pull the wool over the regulator. And so the issue really is, and this is what Basel III is now grappling with, the issue is really how you can allow banks to manage their own risks, because you don't want the supervisor managing risks, you want the banks to manage risks. They will inevitably have their own ways of managing risk. What the regulator has to do is it has to put in some constraints that actually work. You can think of flaws on risk weights. You can say, well, you can look at diversification strategies. So if a bank tells you, I've got this massive portfolio, but don't worry, there's no risk because it's offset. I've got an offsetting position on another totally different portfolio, you can say, well, we limit how much diversification benefit you get for that. And on top of that, you can impose a ratio based on the total assets.
That adds complexity.
I think realistically, one cannot abandon the idea that the assets that a bank has a different riskiness, and I think the regulator has to take account of that. It's a difficult fact of life. But any yes, please.
I'll try to speak up. I've already identified myself. And I think you know me anyway.
Yeah.
Firstly, I have an observation. I think you talked about the manager of a bank the senior management of a bank, that he would be inclined to take more risk because that's the way his compensation is structured. But I think that's actually, if he were to be true to the principle of shareholder value, he should be more... more of a risk taker than if he, let's say, if he incorporated the risk aversion of the a financial supervisor would have them. So there's a problem if you operate banks under the principle of that they should be run to maximize the value of the shareholder. That's an observation of things that have been said. But I have a direct question to Adrian. The proposal that you're making is to segregate the capital markets operations of the banks, especially those, say, involving OTC derivatives, into a non-protected subsidiary. But just before the crisis, there was, as you pointed out, a whole class of these investment banks and even AIG, not theoretically protected by any safety net, but when the crisis arose, the authorities decided they had no alternative but to come in and support them. So how would the proposal that you're making now, they may be legally you don't have to protect these entities, but when a time of crisis appears, the authorities seem to have concluded they could not do otherwise.
Very brief answer, Adrian. Then I'll ask one more question. Allow one more question if there is one, and then we close the session.
Okay, well, thank you for that, because I love that question. You know, in fact, I was at a conference in London last year with Charles Goodhart, was out having a debate with Charles Goodhart on all this, and a lawyer asked more or less the same question. He said, I've got a one-word answer to your proposal of separation, and that one word is Lehman's. Because it wasn't the bank that you could separate, it was already separated. And I just looked at him and I just thought, you know, that's fantastic, because, you know, that's exactly the point. You know, if you learn one thing in economics, when you go to economics 101, what is it? It's the counterfactuals. Get your counterfactuals right. So ask yourself the question, what would those banks, Lehman Brothers, all these other groups have looked like, had what we're talking about been in place at the time? In other words, Citigroup, JP Morgan, everybody was just had their little Lehman's business with them. And if you were going to deal, if Lehman's was going to deal with Citigroup, they wouldn't be dealing with the core deposit-taking institution backed by the FDIC, the government, and all the rest of it. They'd be dealing with someone else where you know you could lose your money. So when that happens, what happens to the pricing of risk? The pricing of risk goes up, and the quantity of risk goes down. So you get a smaller Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers, by the way, had a 20% risk weight, so lending to Lehman Brothers was less risky than lending to a subprime.
I have to say, I think that big banks are normally extremely protective of their babies.
But that's...
The exposure was not in Citibank N.A., and yet it had to stand behind the SIBs and everything else anyway.
No, but Jeff, come on, that's just the way you write the rules. You know, that's if you make it such that you're going to go to prison if you do that, then you don't do it. You know, so you know it's a question of the legislation. You know, banks. I'll give you a good example. There was the bank in Australia, Macquarie Bank, which was a bank, combined bank and securities company. Just before the crisis, they were smart enough to actually use NOHC structure. They separated the bank. It took them about 3 months to do it, by the way, from that. And if you ask anybody in the Australian, and in APRA, the Australian regulators, they'll tell you the only reason why Macquarie Bank is here today is because they did that. They did that. It definitely works, and it's not the case that they wanted to do it to protect themselves from the securities company going under. Okay. So I don't agree with that.
Thank you. Thank you, Adrian. One last short question, if not. Thank you all very much indeed. And thank you very much, Adrian, for stimulating this very lively debate.
Sort of surfacing.
So, can we start now? The final session, which is supposed to start at 11:45, just 5 minutes behind. That's, I think, we are reasonably well checked and time constrained. But I think we should try to aim to finish this session at 1 o'clock. So we have 1 hour and 10 minutes. Now, initially, probably when you got the agenda, Niels Stigerson, one of the really important person initiating the process of European monetary integration, was supposed to write a paper. But unfortunately, Monday last week, I got a bad message that he can't join us and he cannot present a paper. So I thought I should better make some changes in the arrangement for session 4. Anyway, you got a paper by Bill White, not Bill Witherell. He's another person working on financial market issues. Now, Bill wrote a paper which I think has been presented somewhere else. You might have already seen that. It's a fairly bulky paper, 16 pages, and I thought that I should make good use of that because when I told him that the conference will take up the issue of the monetary integration and other things, I left the matter to him to, think on the issues he would like to focus on. He came back with a paper, which you've got, on a European problem. So I thought that that could be a good way of getting into the session without Neil's paper. But at the same time, I saw that we should like to have very structured discussion in session, which means that rather than just have quite a number of participants discussing various aspects of the problem, I thought we should like to, at least myself as a proposal, just focus first of all on the four sets of questions I'm now asking the Secretariat to distribute. But before going to the four questions, I would first like to ask Gunther Baer, who was the original member of the Secretariat, together with the late Tommaso Padius-Chiappa, for the Law Committee. So now, a bit in a retrospective manner, he'll make some analysis of what happened in the course of that deliberation and also in the formation of the so-called Maastricht Treaty, setting particularly emphasis on the fiscal criteria. So, and after that, he'll probably say something about the current issues as he sees them. And I'll come back to you with the responses I got from Niels Stigerson yesterday noon, which are now being distributed. So that, on that basis, I will then pass the floor first to Robert and then to the gentleman from Barcelona. He was the member of the European Parliament, in particular in charge of financial economic issues. So this is the way we like to run this part. Now, after that, we have another session. Going beyond the question I raised, the number of issues we have to discuss. So we'll have, anyway, one part on my question, starting with Gunther Baer, but then we'll come back to another issue not discussed in the context of my four questions. Okay. Gunther.
Thank you very much, Kumi. I hope you didn't promise too much, but let's see. When I received the invitation for this seminar and did not really receive the paper to comment on, I thought I'd sit down and think about it with a view to
how can we manage the, or how, what possibilities are there for a more effective management of the euro area with a view to, let's say, that the current crisis has been overcome already? I not really want to talk about crisis management, not necessarily even about, but indirectly perhaps to some extent, about crisis prevention. In doing so, let me remind you that the management of the Eurozone was discussed on two occasions. The first time in the context of the Delors report, and when its recommendations were then translated into the Maastricht Treaty, and the second time, pretty much right now, in the wake of the present crisis. Let's start with the Delors Committee. The deliberations of the Delors Committee were based on two considerations. The first one was that the committee did not really want to discuss the issue of whether it was desirable to have a monetary union, but what could be done in order to make it viable. And the second one, the committee accepted from the outset a scenario where, for reasons of political reality, the responsibility for economic, which in the Delors report is described as non-monetary policies, would remain in the hands of the national authorities. This was the setup. The continuation of decentralized economic policies in conjunction with a single monetary policy was considered to be possible in a macroeconomic framework of closely supervised, coordinated non-monetary policies in combination with binding rules, as you all know, for budgetary policy. Such rules were seen to be necessary partly because of the limited confidence in market signals, but also to act as safeguards against failures in the coordination, the voluntary coordination of policies. And the decision to abolish exchange rate itself eliminated a key market signal from forex and bond markets. The blueprint of the presented by the Delors Committee was adopted with some amendments, as you all know, in the Maastricht Treaty, but there were two important additions. The first ones, the rules were complemented by quantitative criteria, and perhaps even more importantly, at the same time, the application of these criteria were made subject to interpretation and discretion, political interpretation and discretion. Nonetheless, the framework laid down in the Maastricht Treaty seemed to work extremely well, at least between 1999 and, let's say, middle second half of the 2000s. The ECB succeeded in maintaining price stability and, at least as measured by the harmonized index of consumer prices, and the countries at the periphery, such as Spain and Ireland, which in the discussions of the Delors Committee were seen to be particularly vulnerable to competitive pressures from the center, experienced an unexpected upswing in economic activity and were able to strengthen their fiscal positions. Policy discussions, if any at all, or how to manage the Eurozone, centered on the Stability and Growth Pact. You know, it was violated by two major countries. It was reformed in 2005 to be applied more flexible, but actually when you look at it, it wasn't really strengthened. On the whole, nonetheless, managing the Eurozone was not a very prominent issue at the time. On close inspection, however, there were already developments which should have been seen as warning signals. And I don't want to go into details here, but just to remind you that there were already divergent price developments within national markets. For instance, I think consumer price indicators in Spain and Ireland between 1999 and 2006 moved 2.5 times as fast as those in Germany and Finland.
These developments did not go unnoticed, actually. The ECB commented on it. The ECB also observed that consumer prices tend to affect wages. Consumer price developments tend to affect wages, which tends to affect, as we all know, real exchange rate and exchange rates and competitiveness. Nonetheless, even in spite of these comments, not very much was done about it. Business continued as usual. There were, of course, some good reasons why perhaps these changes in competitiveness were not totally undesirable. We don't have to go into this. The stage for change was set by the global financial crisis of 2007. The bailout of financial institutions, making huge losses on their subprime mortgage portfolio, and the recession of 2008-2009, with sharp declines in GDP, gave rise to a massive deterioration in budgetary positions. Then markets began to focus on sovereign risks, and we all know it was triggered in particular by Greece's unsustainable fiscal position. At this particular point, it did not really matter much whether excessive debt resulted directly from profligate fiscal policies or indirectly from non-performing loans to the private sector. Market finance dried up, and typically the process was sudden, abrupt, and disruptive. Lax fiscal policy did play a role. However, as probably has been discussed already this morning when I wasn't there, the fundamental cause of the crisis must be traced to private sector credit flows. And as the move to the single currency reduced risk premium and lowered interest rates in countries with previously high interest rates, it sparked credit demand in a number of countries, in particular for consumption and property spending, with ample financing provided from national banks and through cross-border flows. As the credit boom was unevenly distributed within the Eurozone, it generated market divergences in GDP growth, inflation, and unit labor costs. The concomitant shifts in competitiveness, together with income effects, gave rise to massive external imbalances. These developments created a situation in which the single monetary policy was by and large appropriate for the Eurozone, but inappropriate for economic conditions in individual countries. It was too loose in countries with rapid growth and too tight where growth was sluggish. In fact, the situation was not much different from Mondell's classic model of demand shifts between two countries, where he demonstrated that a single currency would be desirable only if flexible prices and movements of labor generated the necessary adjustments in order to return to sustainable equilibrium. There is very little evidence that such automatic adjustment mechanisms play a role within the Eurozone. On the contrary, imbalances have increased over time, dashing the hopes of those who had argued that the single currency would set in motion an endogenous process of convergence. With hindsight, therefore, the failure of the Maastricht governance framework to prevent the crisis can perhaps be attributed to three factors. First of all, the rules of the Maastricht Treaty were compromised and binding benchmarks and norms were not observed. Secondly, early warning signals in form of divergent cyclical and competitive positions were largely ignored. And thirdly, there was a lack of awareness of the consequences of a build-up of sizable current account imbalances within the Eurozone financed by private capital flows. Experience has shown that the Eurozone is therefore not an optimal currency area. Imbalances are not automatically adjusted away, and coherence will therefore have to be assured through other means. And the question is, what are the options? Some recommendations call for, let's say, more Europe, which means a fundamental reorganization of the Maastricht Treaty, either by introducing an institutionalized system of Finanzausgleich or financial transfers along the lines of the German Finanzausgleich, or even more far-reaching, a move to what you might call a single fiscal policy. Both proposals are, in essence, political and require a transfer of national sovereignty, transforming the supranational structure of the Eurozone into a federal state. A system of financial transfers would presuppose a high degree of tax harmonization, and a single fiscal policy would imply that national governments and parliaments abandon their responsibility for taxation and spending. This would mean we would really need a complete democratic restructuring of the Eurozone or of the EU. As long as non-monetary policy decisions are left in the hands of national authorities, there is therefore little choice but to continue to manage the Eurozone on the basis of voluntary coordination within the framework of mutual surveillance. A more effective management can therefore only mean a more effective process of surveillance. And as the crisis has demonstrated, this would necessitate improvements in three areas. First, monitoring and limiting public sector indebtedness must be complemented by a careful analysis of private sector debt accumulation and the corresponding financing flows. Second, more attention must be given to heeding the information from wage and price indicators. And third, and most importantly, more emphasis must be placed on prompting early corrective action. The $100,000 question, of course, is how could these improvements be achieved? There are two approaches through which the process of surveillance could be made more effective. The first one would be to refine further the methods of coordinating policies through benchmarks and guidelines, and to strengthen the incentives to encourage their observance and implementation through a more elaborate menu of carrots and sticks. For instance, sanctions could be complemented with rewards for good behavior. However, both for technical and political reasons, there remains serious doubt as to whether this approach would engender significantly more positive results than in the past. First of all, I don't have to explain to you that coordination is technically a very difficult exercise. Participants' views tend to differ about the assessment and interpretation of financial and economic data. Forecasts usually have an element of uncertainty. There are different policy objectives among the countries, and probably the underlying model of how to attain these objectives also differ. All these difficulties are exacerbated in a monetary union, where the key variable for coordinating policies, namely the exchange rate, is lacking. These are the more technical parts, but there are also political considerations which probably make it difficult. It is questionable whether the policy failures of the past were the result of lack of information and inadequate monitoring. All relevant data, in my view, were amply available, but the authorities seemed to be hesitant to make use of them, or were unwilling or unable to respond in a decisive and timely manner. Surveillance relying on peer pressure and the threat of administrative sanctions fall too easily victim to political bargaining. All recommendations are ignored because they are considered politically inopportune. There is indeed a danger that well-intended improvements in the surveillance process may end up in an increasingly bureaucratic exercise of more committees, more papers, more meetings, without really a practical effect. What is the second alternative? The second alternative could be to strengthen the surveillance process by according a more significant role to market signals at an early stage. To this end, surveillance should be conducted with the grain of the market, which means rather than relying essentially on peer pressure and sanctions, much more emphasis should be given to market discipline as a means of prompting member countries to adopt the necessary corrective measures. We know the market pressures emanate from the financial sector, And we are also aware that financial markets exhibit herd instincts, react abruptly, and the withdrawal of market finance tends to compound liquidity problems usually arising in a crisis situation. Yet, I find it, in spite of all what I've heard this morning, hard to believe that financial institutions with large research facilities and risk control departments are not able to interpret correctly the available data. The aim must therefore be to encourage financial institutions to price risks properly. Market behavior is not independent of the regulatory framework within which financial institutions operate. Also, the operations of the intra-European payment system means that intra-central bank finance, in effect, replaces private flows. We all know that regulatory provisions such as zero weighting of sovereign debt or equal treatment of sovereign debt as collateral for borrowing from the ECB are likely to have molded mistaken views on risk. Also, fast and ready assessments of too big to fail may have tempted banks to gamble in expectation of a bailout. And I don't want to quote only as evidence here what was reported recently, the cynical talk of some Irish bankers in the course of the crisis. The key to more rational and reliable market signals and discipline is that those who take risk must be aware that they will also have to bear the consequences of their decisions. Recent revisions in the regulatory framework aimed at stricter and uniformly applied supervision within Europe, in combination with macroprudential intervention at an early stage, should help to sharpen the risk awareness and affect accordingly market behavior. However, for market signals to become an effective means of enforcing policy changes, two additional preconditions would need to be fulfilled. First, after health in the banking system has been restored, banks should not count on public sector support in crisis situations, or not easily count on public sector support in crisis situations. And secondly, the ECB should refrain from intervening in particular bond markets with a view to influencing interest rates. Interest rates on bonds of different countries must be allowed to differ. Only then will these market signals work. Of course, I'm very much aware that these amendments to the present surveillance framework will not really do miracles. Obviously, if there is no strong political will among the participants of the Eurozone, either for self-interest or in the interest of maintaining the Eurozone, all these surveillance exercises will not yield great results. Thank you.
Thank you. Really impressive piece of work on your part. I must say that he spent really enjoyable summer time, first I think in the northeast coast of Siberia, and from there you gave me a signal worrying about the arrival of the paper that you were supposed to comment on. Second, you sent me another mail from Crimea. When I will get the paper? In the end, you not got the paper, but in fact, you really did a marvelous job covering all aspects of the issues I would have liked to discuss, and I will have. Now, I would probably just focus on, as I want to have structured discussion, on some narrow aspect of the issues you've covered. Then I'll pass the floor to my colleagues on my right-hand side. You must have read by now four questions I've raised, so I'll not repeat that. I will go straight to Mr. Figgerson's response, which you've also got. But for the sake of our argument today, let me just read it slowly in English. Question one. The fact that the Greek crisis, which was largely caused by the irresponsible fiscal policies over a long period, came first, did put the label of sovereign debt crisis into wider use than fully justified in characterizing what has happened elsewhere in the euro area. As your background note and Bill White's more detailed analysis show, in some other euro area countries, credit expansion, feeding domestic demand, played a relatively larger role in creating unsustainable conditions and in prompting the sudden stop. Yet, fiscal policy was a major contributing factor, mainly by insufficient attention to the erosion of the structural balance. So, while the overly strong fiscal expansion in the weaker euro area economies in 2009 as part of the global stimulus program, with Spain as the clearest example. He won't say, but my main objection, a mild one, into the downplaying of the role of public finances in triggering the crisis, which your, let me mind, your analysis may be interpreted to imply that the adjustment required to get out of the crisis is largely or entirely private sector deleveraging and improvement in competitiveness. Now, I had exchange of mails with him yesterday evening when I received this, because I thought he misinterpreted my points, and he agreed that I'll make some counter-arguments on this point, because it is a really important one. Now, I don't have to repeat what I've said in my paper. I never said that the euro crisis is a result of private sector savings and investment balances alone. And it was in addition to that. So I said basically a combined result of fiscal imbalances and private sector imbalances in the context of, say, free capital flows within the euro area countries with single money market monetary policy rate. I think, Günther, I thought you agreed with my view. But anyway, we'll come back to that. Now, so it's not really, well, just fundamental problem on the private sector. Imbalances has been encouraged in the context of the European Monetary Union's single monetary policy, which cannot deal with regional imbalances of demand pressure and productivity differences. So I'll go back to Neil's point. Both are happening, which he means the current account improvements and also improvement in competitiveness in your country. Okay, both are happening, but without massive efforts as fiscal consolidation, these adjustments, which necessarily take a long time to have effect, could not work. Such efforts are certainly not ideal from the viewpoint of demand management, but they were necessary to stop the reliance on capital imports, to finance a current account deficit, and begin to restore access to international financial markets, the main purpose of the various official borrowing packages and of the Greek debt restructuring of 2012. Fortunately, this is now beginning to happen, with large current account deficit being replaced by moderate surpluses. Soon, only Greece will need official financing, and only to cover the cost of debt servicing. Without the emphasis that has been put on fiscal consolidation austerity, that will not have been possible. Colleagues such as Paul de Guave, cited in Bill's paper, who suggested euro area countries were somehow pushed from a good equilibrium by unjustified shift in financial market, paint a distorted picture of where the euro area countries were. Question two. Since I accept that there was and still is a crisis of sovereign debt, I have no difficulties with your second question. The main focus has to come from the weaker countries, with Germany's public debt still about 80% of GDP and the economy near full employment. The domestic argument for an expansionary fiscal stance remains, in my view, in Neil's view, weak. I also believe there has not been convincing empirical support for the view that fiscal expansion in Germany would have had strong effect on other euro area economies, as the latter claim. I think that's Grover. Now, criticism of German policy should be confined to two elements. faster liberalization of services and the domestic market regulations, which could stimulate imports, greater readiness to invest abroad than let German excess savings accumulate primarily as foreign exchange reserves. A German foreign wealth, sorry, sovereign wealth fund proposed by Daniel Gross would help to address the latter problem. Germans may be frustrated by the low returns they receive on a savings surplus of currently 7% of their GDP. They could do better by investing abroad, either in other euro area countries or outside the euro area. The latter would indirectly help also the euro area economies with the competitiveness problem with weakening the euro exchange rate. Question 3 and 4. Structural reforms are essential throughout Europe, but particularly in the weaker economies. The OECD has a strong record in offering constructive advice. It is understandable in political terms. The pace of reform had been relatively slow, and as long as fiscal consolidation had to be given high priority. The OMT, the ECB's action, right, announcement last year was successful in gaining some time, in my view, at an acceptable cost of reconciling austerity and reform needs in a better way. What is the progress now made in external adjustment? The prospect of OMT could be allowed to fade. This is an interesting observation on his part. We might like to come back to this later. Perhaps, I don't know whether I have somebody from the ECB, but anyway, we'll continue to discuss. Indeed, it is hard to see how it could actually be used, given the complexity of setting the preconditions for its use. The pressure on governments in highly indebted countries is only off temporarily. As austerity softens, the pressure will be on reform to improve competitiveness further and continue to benefit from much lower interest rates than they could enjoy on their own. I'll stop here and I'll pass the floor to first Robert.
Thank you, Chairman. Well, I'm afraid I will repeat some of the comments made by Niels, but you raised 4 questions, which are indeed 6, because there are sub-questions, I see. First question was, is it a sovereign debt crisis? So I've spent the last 12 years, after leaving the central banks, closer to markets in the asset management industry, and if you ask a fund manager, is there a debt crisis, he will laugh, because it's obvious that there is a debt crisis. There is a crisis on a number of markets of sovereign debts. The answer is yes. During 10 years, investors did not request any risk premium from investors, and they realized they recognized that some countries were in trouble when the impact of the financial crisis of 2008 boosted some public debts. And the market to behave rely on 2 variables. One is the level of the debt, that is to say the debt-to-GDP ratio, which is well known of economists, and the other one is the trend, and therefore they are quite happy to reduce the risk premium in the interest rate, provided the state implements immediately a correct and effective fiscal adjustment. Therefore, my conclusion is, yes, there is a debt crisis in a number of countries, and this requires a fiscal adjustment, even if the reasons for the over-indebtedness are different from the fiscal policy itself. Indeed, what I said doesn't answer the question, where does the excessive public indebtedness come from? The first cause, which is privileged by some authors, for instance, I read a paper by Charles Diplos recently, is fiscal mismanagement. There has been fiscal mismanagement in a number of European countries, especially with incentive given, provided by the very low interest rates for many years. And also for what Gunther mentioned just now, that is to say, and was also mentioned by André Icard at the beginning of the conference, because the Stability Pact has never been applied, never. No country has paid any attention to the debt ratio, and there has never been sanctions to implement the 3% rule. And there are countries which are deficit-prone. I could even say that the country where you are today is a country which is deficit-prone. Over nearly 40 years since the second oil shock, only 1 year of the budget in France was in equilibrium. But you have more striking examples with Greece, for instance, where it was fashionable to increase the number of civil servants doing nothing before and after each election. And there are other examples. But the origin of the difficulty may be different. It may be a balance of payments problem. So, in my view, Bill White tends to insist a little too much on that, but it's fair to say that it's a problem in a number of countries compared to Germany. For instance, if Germany is a benchmark, it may come from a diminution of innovation, it may come from an excessive increase of labor cost, country by country, and even in France, for instance, taxes related to the cost of labor have been increased over time during this period as well. Of course, the adjustment then is not a fiscal effort only. It has to be also either in a more innovation, which takes time, either cutting the salaries, the so-called domestic devaluation, which is very hard to implement. There is a third possible cause for that, which is credit expansion, which is favored, for instance, by Bill White in his paper, I think, balance of payment and credit expansion. In any case, it's excessive demand. And it's true that we have forgotten to look at the figures, the gross figures of the development of credit to household and to enterprise in our countries, because the benchmark was rather the money stock and the price. There are other situations also. For instance, in some countries, which had to rescue banks, the cost of rescuing banks has been very high. It was the case of Ireland, which has a good fiscal situation before the crisis. It's true to some extent in the UK, it's true to some extent in Spain. There is even the last case I mentioned, which is Cyprus. It's a small country, and there you see the spillover effect of the crisis in Greece. To some extent, banks in Cyprus were working to a large extent on the Greek market, and the collapse of Greece had a cost. Therefore, my answer to your second question is that it's case-by-case approach. There is always a debt crisis in weak countries, but there may be something else to do than just fiscal adjustment. The third question was, should budget or current account surplus countries be invited to relax their policy, to increase demand, to reduce taxes, to etc.? Of course, this would certainly please weak economies, because it would give them some fresh air to postpone their adjustment. But it's very difficult to request from a country in surplus, especially in Europe, where the big countries, Germany for instance, as mentioned by Niels Stigesen, is not that in a positive situation. The debt ratio is 80%, and it's an aging population, and therefore I would be the councillor, which I cannot be anymore since yesterday. I would be very reluctant to go too far in this direction. Therefore, Germany will do the minimum which is feasible just to avoid breaking their environment, since after all, Germany, 60% of the German exports go to other European countries. Therefore, we cannot expect too much from that. Your fourth question is about structural reforms. It's obvious that in many European countries, structural reforms are needed, especially here. It's extremely difficult to apply in periods of happy time. Very difficult. To do that, you have to change the social contract. if international organizations put too much pressure on countries, they will not boom just because the public opinion will see the recommendations of the international organizations as breaching the democratic rule. The social contract is in the hands of the national parliament, it's not in the hands of the international organizations. And what we have seen in Europe is that this has occurred recently only in countries which were in a desperate situation, such as Greece, Portugal. Well, in Italy, it was undertaken by Mario Monti. We are many to know Mario well. And then, as a result, 6 months later, he was rejected by the voters. So it's necessary, but it's a problem. And it's a problem which is also the translation of the fact that there is no good communication between international organizations and the public opinion in our various peoples. The opinion, the recommendation of the international organizations have no bearing whatsoever on the public opinion at large in a country, and quite often there is a conflicting situation. Remember the conflicts between the underdeveloped countries and the IMF about the cost, the social cost of the conditionality. This is to say that the international organizations should do something to improve their communication with the public opinion. So I don't know if it's easy to do. There was a 5 point, though you raised 4 questions, which was, do the unconventional operations of the ECB breach the non-Belling clause, which is enshrined in the treaty? I will just make 2 short comments. Firstly, the duty of the ECB, like as it is the duty of every central bank, is to keep orderly markets. This is in the status of the IMF, and this is the transmission mechanism of monetary policy. Therefore, the ECB, I think, has a good case in maintaining alive some elements of market in the public debt, for the public debts of the countries in a desperate situation. And my second comment, I don't think that this is really breaching the non-bailout clause, because, as you know, even the new scheme of OMT will be extended only to countries which are requested the assistance of the stability mechanism or the other countries in Europe. And then for one could interpret the intervention of the ECB as something very close to the bridging operations of the BIS in the past, which was, France has benefited from that many times, giving a loan to a country which was requesting a loan from the IMF, but the procedure was not completed yet. So I would not reject this possibility. That's all, I think, for your 4 or 5 questions.
I'll ask you to come back on other issues not covered in this part of the session. Now, I'd like to call on Carlos Gasoliba, that's the way I would pronounce the name. Well, he is actually president of Barcelona Center for International Affairs, but he was formerly a member of the European Parliament in Economics and Monetary Committee. So you have the floor.
Thank you, Chairman. It's a pleasure to be in to intervene in this seminar. I will try to add a different approach related with your questions. If I understood well, you introduced the necessary bridge between the monetary and financial dimension with the real dimension of the economy. So I agree completely. We have obviously a crisis on soaring debt, but it's in some cases, Spain is a good example, it's the result of a financial debt and that the model of production and the level of competitiveness that was and we reached in 2007 collapsed completely. Yes. as we had a single currency, devaluation, the monetary adjustment was impossible. So the adjustment was through the real economy. And the result is more than 25, around 26% of unemployed people. But that has allowed or, to an adjustment that nowadays allows to have a positive balance of payments and a positive trade. So the cost has been a very high cost, social cost, a political cost, obviously, because the government was punished and a new government was elected a year and a half ago. And as well as the, for the first time in quite a long, long years, for the first time there is a real adjustment in real salaries. Yes. It's necessary to think that between 1998 and 2008, the salaries in Germany were going down in real terms.
Yes.
In Greece, the increase in real real power of purchase of the salaries was 140%. In Spain, was 120%. And in France, I think 110%, more or less. Yeah. But nevertheless, so the adjustment in an open economy, as in the global world and international markets, was obviously necessary. So, and if you look the last, I used to go the method of Helmut Schmidt, that he said that he always read the Economist by the last page, where there are the numbers and the projections, and if you take that, well, the situation of the European economy is not very good. For the moment, we are still being in a decrease. At the end of the year, probably we will have a very slight growth. But this growth, I think, it's not enough. It's very fragile. So the problem is that the possible improvements in the level of competitiveness of our economy and the way out of the financial crisis has not been solved yet. If you take on the other side this grand espoir, the hope of about the solution of the financial crisis on the banking union, that is not completely solved, because the banking union has four elements, and in fact well solved, following the opinion of experts, it's only the supervisory mechanism, but not the three other ones, on resolution, on guarantee of deposits, and on the mechanism to intervene the banks that, or financial institutions that could be in crisis. I have here two studies, one from the Deutsche Bank on the banking union, and the other of the biggest bank of Spain, that it's a former savings bank, one of the few that saved from the completely disappearance of the savings bank in Spain, and both are very critical. Mm-hmm. Both are signaling that the elements to be and to get a real banking union are not yet solved. That it's as well as very important for the other side, from the real economy, because if this situation is not solved, that means that we will still not having the disposition of the level of credits that are necessary to give the right fundamentals or the right basis for the increasing in real terms of the economy in real terms. I mean, all the and that happens in Italy, in Spain, in the Netherlands, in Germany as well. I think that all are asking for to dispose a higher level of credits for the production, for the economy based on production in real terms. And if that doesn't happen, there will be no growth. And there is no growth, the debt problem will increase.
Yes.
And I take the last intervention from the from Mr. Barroso that on the 11th of September made an intervention in the European Parliament about the debate on the state of the Union. And he made in the first part of his intervention saying, well, we have put 700,000 million euros in order to solve the financial crisis. So the contribution of the European Union, it's very important. But and then we now we are on the track for the banking union. He's not critical about what is lacking, but we are on the track of the banking union. But says once he said that, he said, but now what we need is economic growth. Because if there are no economic growth, we will not solve. The economy will not be able to repay the level, the interest of the debt. And the debt is increasing. If we see the data for the main countries in the Eurozone, there is only one that has a positive, has a superavit, not a deficit, that is Germany. Not other one, it's under 3%. Some of them are on 3%. But the rest are clearly in some clearly above 3% as Spain mainly no, I don't mention Portugal or Greece that they have a higher level of deficit, but the problem is that one from my point of view. So more or less, and with some problems and are not are on the track to the banking union. There are quite a lot of critics on the elements that must be solved that are not yet solved. But the other one is the growth. And the growth are not assured. And it's not assured. First, and I will not insist with because I have no time, about the elements that is necessary for the structural reforms. And the other one, because at the European level, there is no response. I think it's very, very negative, and I will end with that, that for the next budget, the so-called multi-annual financial framework, from 2014 to 2020, for the first time, the budget, in real terms, will be less in real terms than the previous budget periods. The so-called now was financial perspective, financial prospect. And that is because the European Union has not the power really for decision, because in the times of Delors and my time in the European Parliament, we thought about a kind of process that was single currency, that will allow to have the monetary union from the fiscal union and to arrive a political union. And it's not yet arrived to this goal, but it's at the inverse. The so-called multi-intergovernmental method is what now is applied really. And I recommend nowadays, today, that the name of Angela Merkel is so popular, I recommend you the lecture of the of his her conference in the College of Europe 3 years ago, saying the intergovernmental method is not so bad, and we are decided to follow that. And let me to remember that the last agreements that allows to try to solve the fiscal imbalances, the two pact and the six pact, are two treaties that were agreed in February and March 2012 that are not a change or new treaty, are international treaties. So, and I think that this aspect that is in the title of this session, the fourth session that was the governance, it's on the grounds of the problems of a real good governance to solve the problems in the European Union. Thank you.
Thank you. Extremely interesting. Now we have a quarter of an hour only. Now I would like to raise one question, which is not in my initial list because I didn't want to have a long list. But coming back to your point, the need for growth inside your area. One of the points I made in my issues paper, let me just read. There is a view that ECB should raise its inflation objective to a higher rate. Now, some even German academics, some of those, I remember, argued for 1 or 0 inflation rate as the target for ECB, now switched their view. I wanted to have Ottmeising today. He was too busy. He could not. I wanted him to write a paper. He could not. But the point I would like to raise to the general audience, not to you, but you should have a view. I am a bit skeptical of this approach, raising to 4%, which is also one, you know, the recommendation by Blanchard, the chief economist of the IMF. Maybe not related directly to the ECB policy, but in general terms, in his rethinking macro policy, he floated out that idea. That is also followed by some others. Now, how to grow? Well, I am not buying. I think Niels Stigson misinterpreted me. I didn't think that I have argued for fiscal expansion in Germany. But the question is, can a change in interest inflation target in ECB would be held. Could anyone respond or other questions? Okay, Jeff.
I'd rather comment on another aspect.
Okay, no, why don't you go ahead?
It's been under current, and in a way it comes back to yours in the end, in several of these sessions, and that is, and we've talked about the fact, we haven't talked yet about the need for symmetry in the surveillance process and in the adjustment process. All of the focus has been on what the countries in deficit or the countries with debt problems have to do, nothing about the obligation of countries that are providing the money and doing the lending. This is an issue that goes back to, to the early 70s when I worked on the Committee of 20, and the issue was how to get symmetry so that Germany had some responsibility. And I think it is still the fundamental issue within Europe. If my version of what happened, the debate over whether it was a fiscal crisis or a private debt crisis is irrelevant. It was a crisis created by lending by German banks into the periphery. And the German banks rightly assumed that they would be taken care of, and their obligations their credits have been paid and replaced by Target 2 balances and by Troika lending. To see them through, and have left the peripheral countries burdened with an intolerable level of debt. Now, a part of this German surplus money flowed to the U.S., And there, at least, they had to take their losses on the RMBSs that they bought. And so that got cleaned up. But I think one has to go back to the question of, can we do more to fix the responsibility on where the money is coming from that feeds into these kinds of problems? And it makes me a little skeptical about Gunners wanting to put more faith in the markets to do this. I'm not sure that we've seen that that works very well.
Well, can I have your view on this ECB targeting? Just one word. Yes or no?
I think it's a side issue. I mean, the real problem, as I said, is that the debt's out there. I'd see the Germany ought to run a larger fiscal surplus to eat more of the losses that have been incurred in Southern Europe. And I think that would help.
Okay. Now, Wolfgang Michalski was initiator of the OECD positive adjustment policy, PAC, with Hans Dietmeyer as chairman, I think, of the EBC at that time.
Yeah.
So, okay, Wolfgang.
Thank you, Kumi. I have no difficulties to agree with you and Bill White that the euro crisis is essentially an balance of payment crisis, because sovereign debt is only part of the problem, in particular if we think of Ireland or Spain. I also agree with the thesis that creditor countries have a responsibility now in solving the crisis. But I have difficulties to follow the recommendations of Bill White to a great extent. Mm-hmm. First of all, we spoke about expansionary fiscal policy in Germany. Germany has for the first time a structural surplus this year, but they are far away from 60% of GDP. They are above 80 still, and they have to bring this down, not only because of the Maastricht criteria, but because we have an aging population, and perhaps even, this depends on immigration, a diminishing population, which both will bring enormous pressure on the budget in Germany. The other point, wage inflation, which is also mentioned in Bill White's paper. First of all, wages, in particular in the private sector, are not a policy parameter in Germany. It's negotiated between the employers and the unions. Mm-hmm. And in the public sector, I think there's no leeway because of the budget. So forget about wage inflation. And anyway, I would say the strategy for resolving the crisis should not be the strategy in terms of competition to adjust to the bottom. We should adjust to the ceiling, if possible. Now, what should creditor countries do? I will be short. First of all, I think they have the obligation to further reform and develop the system. This has started with the European Stability Mechanism, with the Banking Union, with the Stability Pact, and there may be many other reforms needed. The second thing is, I think they have to provide financial assistance as appropriate. But my point here is, and this one has not yet been discussed here, is under very hard conditionality. And now, why? When I did the structural adjustment work at the OECD and later on a study on the cost and benefit of protection, I introduced the concept of political economics into the analysis, and I discovered that there are asymmetries in political processes which always are against reform and for protectionism and for the status quo. I will give you one example. If you liberalize or deregulate an industry, you will find immediately enormous powerful forces against this. Because there are jobs in danger if these industries are regionally concentrated, there are whole regions in danger. But on the other hand, the benefits of such measures, the contribution to economic growth, the contribution to macroeconomic productivity, the contribution to combat inflation, they are diffuse. They are very thinly spread all over the economy, and they do not generate the same kind of pressure. Now, if you want really into southern European countries economic reform, then you have to put these governments under enormous pressure because they have the opposite pressure already. Okay, there's one point which I always emphasized in our OECD exercise, which was not in the US concept of structural adjustment at the time, that of course you have to adjust as speedily as you can to changing political, economic, social, and technological circumstances. But you have also to pay attention that the adjustment process is politically feasible and socially acceptable. And I think there is a very difficult line, which, of course, credit governments have to look at. Now, there are other measures, I think, which credit governments can do. Niels Tugendsen mentioned that we should further reform and liberalize product and service markets in creditor countries, and I would not say only in Germany, I would also say in the Netherlands, in France and elsewhere, because there is a lot of overregulation still. There is even protectionism inside the European Union, and there we can contribute to more dynamic growth. This is part of the growth strategy. The question is whether there might not also be a more shorter-term approach to more growth through major European investment programs, which could be financed without enlarging the national budget deficits. I think of programs in infrastructure, be it transport, energy, or network infrastructure all over Europe, financed on the basis of the structural funds of the European Union, which are not used today fully, financed through the European Investment Bank, and maybe even the idea of a wealth fund may play a role here. The problem might be the planning and the implementations of such ideas.
Okay. Thank you, Wolfgang. So far, we discussed the responsibilities of deficit or debtor countries in the euro area and creditor surplus countries, Germany. We have not discussed really the second important country, this country. And when I had some discussion on this with the French economist just a week or so ago, one observed everything is becoming better, but the other two disagreed. Fundamentally, problem exists in my meaning, France, too. You know, we talked about the divergence of price competitiveness, so forth, where to find growth here in this country at a time when you need fiscal consolidation. I would not like to open the floor on this part, but since this conference is taking place at the heart of France, at the heart of city of Paris, I would like to invite somebody from the French audience who would like to say something. What, in your view, should be needed to go ahead with further and better management of the euro, the second important country, that's France? Anybody? Oh, tant pis. Mesdames et messieurs, y a-t-il? Vous êtes français, monsieur? Non? Quelqu'un? Okay, well, I think I should not...
No, let's get back to Germany.
I'll turn back to...
Let's get back to Germany. First of all, I know we have a very strict chairman, so I'll try to limit my remarks and be very, very...
No, I can go. I think we can have 5 minutes or so.
But I have difficulties already when we start discussing Europe with the notion of the European economy. I don't see the European economy, to be quite frank, not really in existence. I see national economies with various linkages and a common monetary policy, but not more. So the idea of managing Europe as a unit, we don't have the instruments, we don't have the political will. I don't really think this is the way we can approach this issue. Second point was we should
reignite growth. Fine. If the only impediment to growth is the fact that the banking sector is reluctant currently to support or finance industry, medium, small-sized, medium-term, medium-sized industries, then I would ask myself, why is this the case? And I guess it's still the weakness of balance sheets in most of these countries that it's not being done. And in fact, I can give you even examples from Germany that it's not being done. But apart from this, if this is the alternative, then we hear, and this is also a little bit of bills and indirectly a little bit of burden sharing, which I heard from Jeff Schaefer over there, should Germany reflect or follow a more expansionary fiscal policy? I think most has been said about it, but let me add one aspect on top of it. What would it really do if Germany, what would it do for the Eurozone if Germany indeed would add 1 or 2 percentage points to its budget deficit? I mean, the mechanisms we are all familiar with, it would probably stimulate to a small extent some imports. Imports from where? Imports from the Eurozone? I have my doubts about this because the Eurozone is not competitive. No. It's not competitive with respect to the rest of the world. Right. So what else could it do? Of course, I mean, if Germany would follow a more aggressive fiscal policy, maybe we could manage, but I'm not sure how we would do this, to have a higher rate of inflation than the rest of the Eurozone countries and therefore indirectly reduce the German competitiveness and help the others. But I think this is not something that a German politician would really subscribe to create a higher rate of inflation. It's extremely difficult. Another way of helping probably the creditor countries is to participate in a write-off of debts. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about this. But Jeff, the real problem is not that the German banks have financed it and therefore they were smart enough perhaps to get out. But there are many others, and they are very reluctant to any kind of write-off because other banks would suffer from it. So I think the whole picture is not only that the German banks have financed Cyprus or Greece or Spain. I have to say this for the defense of Germany, of course, being German. So I think I want to leave it at this as just a very few short remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. I think I should better tell you that although I set the rule of the game, and that you should not feel rude in leaving the conference room as from now on. I don't think we should take it rude to you. I think, on the other hand, if you are interested in continuing, I think 10 minutes or so continuing, that'll be okay, because there are some who are really signaling me. Is that okay? So, Adrian and Fit, you, and also I recognize Paps and Peter still, right? Three people. Can I just close there and then okay. Hi, Adrian.
Okay, I did want to say something about it. I wasn't going to, but I thought I'd better. I think for me, and this is again a personal view, not obviously not an OECD view, I don't think this is a sovereign crisis in the sense that, well, of course there's a sovereign debt problem. Of course it's there. But the question, when people ask that question, they're really asking, is this a causal thing or is this a result thing? Mm-hmm. And for me, the number one problem, I agree with what Jeff said in terms of the banks, obviously, and you've heard me a bit about that. But I think the really big problem in Europe is the existence of the euro itself. And what we're getting here is a really strong lesson in the Heckscher-Ohlin theorem on the one hand and optimum currency areas on the other. Because what you've really got in Europe is there's a major industrial revolution going on in the world. Asia, China, all these places, Latin America, it's all happening. And people have said repeatedly, competitiveness is the big problem for Europe. Well, of course it is. But what you've got here is the classic optimum currency area problem. Optimum currency area theory says that if a region is being subjected to asymmetric real shocks, then a floating exchange rate is the only option. So what we have here is in the north of Europe, we have these countries more or less vertically integrated into the Asian industrial revolution, where they're basically supplying high technology, capital goods, and so on and so forth. So they've benefited from that. The south of Europe is competing with that same area and very, very poorly. So in some sense, the north of Europe is helping the Asian area to sort of hurt the south of Europe, which is a classic case where you should have a floating exchange rate. But we don't have it. No. So what's going to happen is we'll go on and on and on. I'm not predicting there'll be a floating exchange rate in the south or a Charlemagne euro or something like that. But what will happen, in my view, is that more and more, the Heckscher-Ohlin part of this is more and more the exchange rate becomes nominal wages. And so the nominal wages in the south go down and down, and then people leave. So what we're going to have over a very long time is depopulation in the south of Europe, especially with people who can leave. That's what's going to happen here.
I think we should turn microphone to Peter Stern. Peter. Is the microphone coming?
I probably am going to repeat only what has been said already, but it's probably worthwhile because it's so important. And that is that the euro cobbled together a bunch of countries with completely different social basic attitudes, and then removing the safety valve of the exchange rate and expecting those countries to converge, which is a very high demand on those countries. So, and in this sense, I'm very pessimistic, as Adrian is, that that problem can be solved, but it ought to be solved, and we should try. And the least we could do is try to get some response or put some demands on the surplus countries to contribute to the solution, to give the other countries, the laggards, some time to do the necessary adjustment. Whether they will ever achieve it is another question, but at least we should give them some time to do that. And one way of doing that is indeed increasing the inflation target for the euro area. But the idea behind this is not have higher inflation everywhere. The idea is to have differential inflation, which is higher in Germany and lower in the countries that need to adjust, to eliminate more quickly the existing difference in competitiveness, which is the only way to get growth going in the overall euro area. And if you don't manage that, then give up all hopes for any solution in the short or in the long run.
Okay, now I'll finish with the... Paul Atkinson, and then I think we should just go to the debate.
Thank you. I think Adrian and Peter have covered a lot of what I was about to say. I just couldn't help reflecting, as Gunter made his presentation, my immediate reaction was, well, why have you got a single currency? Isn't this precisely the circumstance in which you should let exchange rates do the adjusting, and particularly in the context of some of the suffering that... Greece obviously has done. I cannot understand why letting the fringe countries who should never have been in the system in the first place just drop out and take care of themselves was not the way to go, when all the discussion that I've heard has all either been cataclysm and the Eurozone breaks up into 17 different separate outfits, or no change, maintain the status quo.
Well, I would like... And the last speaker, Leif.
Thank you. Well, my conclusion is, as I hinted before, that within this monetary union, one must have realistic expectations and levels of ambition. And it appears from this discussion, too, that it has been confirmed, I think, that with these debt levels and these levels of financial assets on the other side, and with these enormous imbalances in competitiveness, they cannot be corrected inside this monetary union. That's my conclusion. And several speakers have said the same things. So we have to adjust our expectations to what is realistic to be achieved inside this system. And if we are not happy with this outcome, then we must try to find some alternative to this economic system, whatever that is. And I doubt we can do it without the cost of transition being even bigger. But to get out of these two imbalances inside the monetary union without these adjustment mechanisms, this discussion of 3 hours have not provided one clue to how that can be done. Maybe that is a bit harsh, but that's my conclusion. We end up now with several speakers saying we cannot do this, we cannot do that. Germany cannot expand. Mm-hmm. We cannot provide demand from here. And if we raise the inflation target, that will not produce very much difference. So we'd better adjust our expectations to what is realistic to expect in the world where we actually live. Thank you.
Thank you, Lai. Particularly important from the politician and the economist. And I think I should just close the session and the conference itself. So thank you for all you have done. Final word. We don't like to finish by just this discussion. I would like particularly journalists, I think there are some,